That's hilarious. This episode of Joe Rogan Experience Podcast is brought to you by Stamps.com. If you go to Stamps.com and click on the upper link, there's a photograph of an old school microphone, you know, the kind that everybody likes to use in photographs. Nobody likes to use those stupid things in practice because they suck. But for whatever reason, there's a certain piece of nostalgia that's connected to one of those old school microphones, like the birth of the beast. Like that's the origin of it. So for whatever, talking into a microphone, people love that. But click on that thing. It's an icon. And enter in the code word JRE, just for Joe Rogan Experience. And you will get a $110 bonus offer. It includes a digital scale and up to $55 free postage. Stamps.com is an awesome thing to have if you are running a personal business, if you have a small business. And you work for yourself. You know, maybe you're an artist. Maybe you send things online. Going to the post office is a huge drag for people. And with something like Stamps.com, you can buy and print official U.S. postage using your own computer and printer. If you buy any of Brian's Kitty Cat t-shirts, those Death Squad shirts at DeathSquad.tv, he sends all his stuff for like anything he sells, bumper stickers, t-shirts, all that stuff goes through Stamps.com. And he used to have to do it at the going to the post office and waiting in line. It's a huge pain in the ass. So it's really easy. You do it all on your own home computer. You have a digital scale. You weigh everything out. Put the postage on it. Mailman picks it up. Boom. You're done. And again, use the code word JRE and you'll save yourself some cash. We're also brought to you by Hover. Hover is a domain name company that's owned by the same people that own Ting. And you know how much we love them. Hover has the same sort of principles. Hover is a really easy website to use, very intuitive. I actually have domains that I have personally registered through Hover. So I have actual experience doing it. And if a monkey like me can pull it off with no hitches, you can too. They also offer good stuff, like they give you free things like Whois domain name identity guard, where your anonymity. So you don't have to, the actual word is privacy. Whois domain name privacy. But that's basically what it is. Like, so if you have some freaky website and you don't want people to know where you live, which is probably a good idea, they will do that for free. Whereas other companies, Whois domain name privacy is actually something you have to pay for, which is kind of silly. If you go to hover.com/Rogan, you will save 10% off your domain name registrations. All right, so go there, you freaks. And we're also brought to you by Onnit.com, as always. I've always searched for a way to describe what Onnit's supposed to be. And it's like a human performance website. What we sell is all stuff that we find to be beneficial, whether it's for fitness, like kettlebells and battle ropes and weight vests and medicine balls and chin-up bars and all sorts of things that I think are very beneficial for fitness, to get your body in shape to do things, to foods like hemp protein powder and walnut almond cashew butter. We try to just sell you a bunch of healthy shit, like whatever hemp protein bars, which are really delicious and nutrient dense. And I think the idea behind the company is just sell shit that you would use. Sell shit that you would buy and you would use. And that's essentially what Onnit is. If you use a code name Rogan, you will save 10% off any and all supplements. See how quick I can get through that shit, Jamie?
Boom.
That was quick. That was like professional. All right, ladies and gentlemen, Graham Hancock is here. And I can't tell you how fucking pumped I am to talk to you, sir. And cue the music. Let's get this party rolling.
Joe Rogan Podcast, check it out.
The Joe Rogan Experience.
Train by day, Joe Rogan Podcast by night, all day.
Powerful Graham Hancock. How are you, sir?
I'm good. Just fine.
You've kicked the green bitch.
Yes, yes. After a 24-year intense relationship with the green goddess or the green bitch, depending on what mood she's in, I had to stop. I've come in for some criticism for this, and I feel it's important to say that I hugely value and love cannabis. I think it's a wonderful herbal ally. And I don't think that I would ever have written my books of historical mystery if I had not encountered cannabis rather late in life. I did not smoke any dope until I was 37 years old, and I'm now 62.
Wow.
And roughly around about the age of 38, that's when I started getting into historical mysteries. Before that, it was all...
Of course, it's total stoner stuff.
Absolutely. Before that, it was all current affairs, you know?
Right.
So, but suddenly something opened up for me, and I'm very grateful to the herb for that. And initially, I need to emphasize this. I think the problem I eventually ended up having with cannabis, it's not the fault of cannabis. It's the fault of Graham Hancock. I think my relationship became abusive with the herb. It was not initially.
Right.
Initially, it was something I would do evenings and weekends. I would not try to write while I was actually stoned. I would do my day's work and then chill out in the evening with a pipe or a joint. That was how it was for me for quite a while. And I went through my first big historical mystery book, The Sign and the Seal, which was published in 1992, with that pattern. In other words, that I would be smoking only after I downed tools at the end of the evening and I was ready to chill.
Mm-hmm.
And that worked fine. But then when I started writing Fingerprints of the Gods, which was the biggest book I've ever done, a 5 million copy bestseller all around the world, when I started writing that, I thought, I'll experiment. Let's see if I can be stoned and write. And I discovered that I could. I could be stoned and write. And I liked being stoned so much that, in a way, it urged me to just write all the time, you mm-hmm. know, because then I had this incredibly good reason to be stoned all the time. And it took away all the physical boredom of sitting there in my chair in front of my computer screen. Just everything went away, and I drifted into this space where I could explore ideas and manifest those ideas down on the page. And I literally, that's when I began what was to become ultimately an abusive relationship with cannabis, which is that I would fire up, in those days, my joint or my pipe at 9 or 10 in the morning. And I'm a hard worker. I work 16 hours a day very often when I'm writing. So come 2 o'clock the next morning, I'd still be there smoking away. And as the years went by, this became a permanent daily pattern for me, whether I was writing or not. I would be stoned from the moment I got up until the moment I went to bed. And most people who came by my house or talked to me on the phone, they would have had absolutely no idea, because I was completely in control. I didn't seem high. I could hold a rational conversation. I was just fine. And I just felt really good. And this is how it went on for many years. And later on, around about 2005, actually, I think, perhaps a little earlier, one of my kids told me that, you know, this stuff, this smoke is, you don't need to have combustion products. Why don't you use a vaporizer? So I bought myself a Volcano and on the internet. And then I heard that the British government was going to ban all peripherals. So I bought myself 2 more Volcanoes. Volcanoes are quite expensive, but that shows how dedicated I was.
You had to make sure that you covered your bases.
I had to make sure that I covered my bases. And then I would be vaporizing from 9 in the morning until 2 o'clock the next morning, wow, 7 days a week. And increasingly strong strains. And this is one thing that I would say. If we lived in a regime, an irrational regime, where there was no attempt by the government to police our states of consciousness, we could have much more choice in the kind of cannabis we get hold of. For example, I would have liked to have cannabis with much more CBD and maybe less THC. Hmm. But the varieties I was smoking were very, very THC loaded.
And what's the difference in effect?
Well, okay. I mean, it depends how much you buy into the research on this, but the... A lot of good science has been done, and the suggestion is that THC can promote or reveal. I don't want to blame the herb for anything.
Mm-hmm.
It can reveal certain psychotic tendencies in oneself,
mm.
and this is the well-known paranoia, which many people associate with smoking cannabis. The CBD is an antipsychotic agent, so the natural herb is balanced with CBD and THC. And it looks after you very well. But where we go into intensive breeding of the herb, focusing on the element that makes you really high, which is the THC, then we get a herb that is somewhat unbalanced as a result of the interference of humanity. But you get more bang for your buck. You know, that's a very that's a very strong herb. And I began to like a particular variety called cheese, I think it's called cheese because it smells like, you know, old socks or Stilton, you know, like a blue cheese.
Mm-hmm.
And I found a grower who lived local to me who was just had amazing green fingers and I would buy from him. And I would sometimes have, you know, 5 or 6 ounces of the herb in my house because I was blazing through this stuff at a tremendous at a tremendous rate.
That's enough to you where you could get in trouble for
well,
dealing.
that's where the paranoia starts to become legitimate, you know, because actually they can they can break down your door and they can confiscate your home and take away your liberty and fuck you up forever. You know, they can do that. And so every time I heard a ring at the door or, you know, a car came up the street, I would you know, get paranoid.
And you were high, so that didn't help.
And I was high, yeah, and I was high.
Did you get paranoid when you were high?
Well, this is one of the reasons why, look, what happened to me was that around about 2003, I started, for reasons of research initially, working with ayahuasca, the vine of souls. This is the powerful psychedelic brew which has been consumed by shamanistic cultures in the Amazon for thousands and thousands of years. And it's not called the Vine of Souls for nothing. It's it's an extraordinary portal into other realms. And in some ways, those realms are associated with death and perhaps what waits for us after death. Nobody knows the answer to that. But in ayahuasca, you have certain experiences relating to that. And right from the beginning, when I started to drink ayahuasca, I mean, this sounds nuts to anybody who hasn't done DMT or who hasn't drunk ayahuasca, but you do meet intelligent entities. And more around the world, people drinking ayahuasca are meeting this goddess figure. She might appear as a serpent. She might appear as a woman. She might appear as some kind of panther or jaguar. Very powerful, tough love kind of lady who reveals to you the truth about yourself and just says, you know, you fucking deal with it because that's how you are.
Right.
And what the truth that was revealed to me from quite early on was my relationship with cannabis had got out of balance and I needed to get it back into balance. And of course, I ignored those messages completely because I was so much in love with my cannabis relationship. In fact, my wife said that really it was like I had a mistress, you know, who I spent all my time with was the cannabis rather than her. And this went on for many, many years. Now, the paranoia aspect, okay, I'm going to bare my heart here. And, you know, I believe in being honest. The paranoia aspect began to affect my relationship with my beloved partner, Santha, who I just love from the bottom of my heart. And she is the best, the most pure-hearted, generous-spirited, loving lady it's possible to imagine. But I started to develop all kinds of suspicions about her, which were completely groundless. I started to imagine all sorts of stuff were going on, and then I started to act towards her as though those suspicions were real. And all of this was also related to my consumption of cannabis. It was not caused by my consumption of cannabis. I think this is a latent aspect of my own personality. It was being revealed by this over abuse of the cannabis herb.
Right.
And therefore, I was making my beautiful partner's life a misery sometimes. Not every day, but sometimes. And she was patiently putting up with this, but she was suffering.
Hmm.
And we went down to Brazil in October 2011. And if I had been told when we got on that plane and went down to Brazil, that when I came back 2 weeks later, I would probably never smoke cannabis again, I would have laughed in the face of the person who told me that. But the encounters that I had with the spirit of ayahuasca, whatever that is, I'm willing to accept that there is no spirit of ayahuasca, that it's all something we generate out of our brains. But mm-hmm. for me, she manifests as a real, like a goddess.
Right.
And the encounters I had with that, and I do think she's real. That's just my personal belief system.
Right.
And those encounters that I had were incredibly powerful. And she took me to a place that was something like hell. And she took me to a place that was something like the judgment scene in the ancient Egyptian religion. Now, the judgment scene is a place where your heart is weighed in the scales against the feather of truth and harmony and cosmic justice. And you do not want your heart to be heavy in those scales. You want to be able to look back on your life and say, I did good. I did not add to the misery in the world. I did something worthwhile with this incredible gift of life that the universe gave me. And everything you've done, every second, every minute of your life is completely transparent. Every thought, every action, everything you did from the moment you became conscious until the moment of your death is laid out before you, and there's no hiding from it. Like, we're great at creating illusions about our own behavior and persuading ourselves that we're behaving just fine. In the Judgment Hall of Osiris, which is also called the Hall of Maat, where this scene takes place, all of that stripped away, and you confront the truth. And I was put there, and I confronted the truth about myself, and I saw the way that I was behaving towards my partner, and I was shown that this had to stop. Otherwise, I was going to pay a huge price for it. And I had a series of terrifying experiences, which my partner Sansa shared with me, because we were drinking ayahuasca together, and at a certain point entities came to her, and she had the experience of her heart being pulled out of her chest, and the entity said to her, and she thought she was going to die, and the entity said to her, "We're going to do this to you to teach Graham a lesson." And Sansa communicated that to me, and I would rank that as probably the single most terrifying night of my entire life. And I've had some terrifying nights. That was just absolutely scared, rigid. And I came out of that with a feeling, a very clear feeling. In ayahuasca, we have sharings. The next day after you've drunk the brew, you share with the rest of the group who you've drunk with the experiences you had the night before, as much as you want to share. And what I shared, because I still didn't believe that I could stop smoking cannabis, what I shared was that I was going to change my relationship with cannabis and to get to a place where cannabis was serving me again rather than me serving her. And that's what I believed. But when I got back to England, long flight, what's the first thing I do? I get out my vaporizer, get out my stash, fire up the vaporizer, and fill a nice bag of of a vapor.
You say it so nostalgically.
Well, I miss it. I miss it. You know, this was cannabis is such a beautiful, sensual ally if she's used right.
And so, do you think it's just an imbalance issue with the CBD THC ratio?
And well, let me just finish with what happened to me. So, I fill up the bag and I'm down there in my basement, and I take the first draw, and I'm suddenly filled with the most intense feelings of horror and loathing. And it is exactly like I'm back in that space that ayahuasca took me to. And I try a second puff, and I can't do it. I physically could not continue. I knew that I just could not continue. I expressed the vapor out of the bag. Wow. I crumpled up the bag. I put it away. And the next day, I got rid of several ounces of cannabis.
Yeah. Son!
I know. It's terrible. It's a terrible thing to do. But for me, it was the right thing to do. 24 years... non-stop relationship with cannabis, definitely abusing the herb. I had got to the point where the only rational course of action was what I was shown in ayahuasca, which was to stop. And I don't know whether it was because there was way too much THC and not enough CBD, or whether it was just me not being responsible for my own behavior. I go around, you know, saying that I believe in adult responsibility, and I do, but I don't think I was being responsible. I don't think I was using the herb in a responsible way. I don't think I was using it in a respectful way, right. And I paid a price for that.
Well, that's very honest and forthcoming of you to talk about it. And it's very uncomfortable for people to discuss mistakes they've made or paths they've gone down that they didn't, for whatever reason, they got caught up in the momentum. They didn't see where it was headed until they hit the wall. Mm-hmm. It sounds like you have a legitimate, like, chemical reaction to it. It doesn't just sound like... it doesn't just sound like an abusive relationship, because the effect that it was having, the extreme paranoia effect and the unease. Mm-hmm. Do you take care of your body? Do you work out? Do you do any exercise?
Not enough. I do some calisthenics. I don't do a whole lot of.
You should do yoga. How do you not do yoga? You should do yoga, man.
Yeah.
Graham Hancock, yoga has your name on it.
Oddly enough, somebody's come up to me recently and suggested I join a yoga class.
Listen, man, you have to join it yesterday.
Okay.
For real.
Yeah.
It's for a guy like you, because it's a way to get high without doing any drugs. Mm-hmm. There's only one time in my whole life I did it, but I got so high after a yoga session that it was like I just smoked weed. Like I felt exactly like I just smoked a lot of weed. And I was sitting there in a hotel room and I was like, this is incredible. Like, I would swear I'm high as fuck right now.
Right.
I hadn't smoked in days.
Okay.
And it gives you, it's a reset. It gives you a reset. It gives you, like, to me, like, gets rid of the excess and balances mm-hmm. things out. Like there, you can. You know, the reason why people have road rage and they're reacting so strongly to nothing. What mm-hmm. a guy got in front of you, and it's going to take you three extra seconds to get where you're going.
And you go crazy.
Yeah. Fuck you and yeah. fucking. That is not him, and yeah. that is not this. The guy. Yes, maybe he shouldn't have done that, but does yeah. it even bother you? Does it mean anything?
Massive overreaction.
People make
yeah.
mistakes. The guy got yeah. in front of you. What's the big deal?
Yeah.
That's it's built up. It's okay. built up, and there's imbalance. Right. There's energy imbalances in people. And
yes.
We're stuck in cubicles or doing jobs that we don't appreciate, and people blow up. Mm-hmm. And the best way to avoid that kind of stuff, to me, is yoga.
Yeah. Well, but what about all the stretching and the, you know, the joint, right. like my knees and my hips? I had my hip replaced 6 weeks ago.
By oh, my God. You 6 weeks ago?
Yeah, 6 weeks ago.
You're walking around like you're fine.
Yeah, 6 weeks ago I was in hospital. I got a massive scar down the outside of my right thigh. They
wow.
went in there and replaced my hip. But I guess one could start gently and just sort of build up.
Now, you would have to talk to an expert about that, because yeah. I don't know what physical limitations.
Yeah. Apparently none. The surgery's gone well, and
wow.
I'm all set.
So yeah. they told you could go running?
I can go running. I can go swimming. I can do anything, yeah. yeah.
Wow, yeah. That's incredible.
Yeah.
That's incredible. And it's like, it's a serious operation.
It's a serious operation. I know it's a serious operation because I opted to stay awake during it.
Oh, my God.
Well, I'm a writer, you know. I have to have stuff to write about.
Oh, that's hilarious. Did you tell them that?
Yeah, I did, yeah. And so what they do is they give you a spinal. So it's
an epidural.
It's a bit like an yeah. epidural that women get when they're giving birth.
Right.
It's slightly different, but that's basically what it is. And that freezes the lower half of your body. You use the use of your legs, you're paralyzed, and there's no pain whatsoever. But then, because they regard the operation as the surgery as a kind of scary procedure, they then give you a massive dose of sedatives, and you kind of go off into dreamland. So I declined those. And they wouldn't actually let me look. They put some kind of curtain device between my face and my hip. But I heard the sawing.
Oh, my God.
And then
Jesus.
I heard the hammering.
Oh, my God.
And I felt
God.
Like a piece of furniture on a carpenter's bench, you know. It was when I heard them talking. It was interesting. It was an interesting experience. But then very nice to come out of it, be fully awake afterwards, and gradually the feeling comes back to your legs. And I spent 4 days in hospital. And initially, I thought it was going to be very tough. And I thought I'd be on sticks for a long time, but I did the physio, and I just carried on working at it, and I'm okay.
I stayed awake for my first knee surgery.
Right.
And while the guy was working, it was really weird, because I was like half in it and half out of it.
Yeah.
And he was, you know, he was just a guy that was like tired of being a doctor. Or, like, really wasn't into people or whatever
right.
it was. I mean, he fixed my knee. It's still fixed this day. It's a patella tendon graft where they
right.
take a slice of your patella mm-hmm. and they open you up and take a piece of bone out of your shin and a
right.
piece of bone on your kneecap, and they use that to replace your anterior cruciate ligament.
Right.
And he puts it in there and like moves my leg around and goes, well, better than it was. That's what he said.
That's what he said.
Like, I was awake.
Right, right.
Like,
right.
I don't know if he just forgot I was awake
yeah,
or thought
yeah.
I wouldn't remember,
yeah.
but I remember him moving around like, well, better than it was. Like that's it? Not, we've got it done.
Yeah.
Beautiful job. This young man will be
yeah.
up and walking in no time.
Just
no.
better than it was. That's the limit of his ambition.
His attitude was just like so, he didn't give a fuck. And I remember visiting him to get it looked at, like
yeah.
after, you know, he would like want a checkup to see mm-hmm. how it was like months later. The guy just didn't like people. You
mm-hmm.
could tell.
Mm-hmm.
He had this thing. It was just done. Just
right.
done. There was no bedside manner.
Yeah.
He was courteous. He wasn't yelling at you or anything,
yeah.
but it was just.
You were just another piece of meat on the table.
Yeah.
yeah.
It's weird to watch, though, isn't it? Your body getting operated on.
It's a very strange experience to undergo.
Yeah.
In my sense, in my case, as I say, I was not able to watch it because they put up a curtain, but I heard it. And the particular things that I heard were sawing and hammering.
I saw it on a screen.
Right, I didn't.
I didn't watch it. I couldn't watch
yeah.
it in front of me, but I saw what was happening on
right.
screen.
Right.
It was crazy. It was real weird. They were opening you up like a fish. And,
yeah.
But the hip replacement is a gigantic one.
It's a big surgery.
How is it 6 weeks later and you're walking around like you're great?
Well,
you didn't have a limp at all.
No, I guess I guess in some ways I must have been reasonably fit and got on. You know,
that's good.
Got back.
That's
got
very important.
Yeah,
because I know for folks that are like overweight or you know have issues already,
yeah.
they allow like, a hip injury to let them get overweight.
Yeah,
that's a big rehabilitation.
It's a big thing, and it is major surgery. But
they chop the end of your bone off, right?
Yeah. So we're made in a way. Our bodies are like machines, and we got this ball and socket joint in the hip. And so the ball is on the end of the long bone, the femur, I think it is. And they chop that off. That comes off. Okay? And then the socket, in my case, there were cysts in the socket, which were hollow spaces that had come in there because of the ball joint was out of kilter and it was rubbing in the wrong way. And this is why I was in severe pain for a year before this happened.
Wow.
And so they put in a titanium unit there where the socket is, and they put a titanium shaft that they hammer down into the bone.
Oh.
But then on the top of the titanium is ceramic. So the actual bearings, both the titanium socket is lined with ceramic, and the bearing that moves around in it that sits on top of the titanium shaft, that's also ceramic. So there's no metal rubbing against metal,
mm-hmm.
which has caused problems in the past. People get fragments of metal into their bloodstream and so on. Ceramic on ceramic bearings. And it's very good. You know, it works well, and I'm not in pain. And that very bad period of not being able to walk more than a quarter of a mile without having to sit down and recover, that's all gone.
It's incredible. Yeah. I mean, how long is it going to be before we have bionic bodies?
Well, it's already happening. We are already getting bionic bodies, and this is one of the good things which medical science has done. Some terrible things, but one of the good things it's done is I mean, if this had happened 50 years ago, I would have been crippled at the age of 62. I couldn't have gone on with my life.
That's what eventually did in Hunter Thompson.
Right.
He was in constant pain.
Pain.
Yeah, I believe he had hip replacement too, but it was like old school. You know, they didn't really.
Yeah, they've got a lot better.
A lot better. Yeah, that's the image right there. Yeah. But we're looking it up on that screen.
There we go. Yeah.
Oh, God, yeah. Graham Hancock.
Yeah. That's what happened to me.
Jesus, Louises.
Yeah.
Woo! It's
a funny thing to look at it on
it's
the x-ray.
It's crazy. Yeah. The idea that you're going to run around on that, that's a fake joint.
And, you know, I asked him, when you hammer that titanium shaft down inside the bone, is there any danger that you can split the bone? And he said, yeah, sure. We sometimes split the bone. But he said, then we just bind it with wire.
Oh, my God. You just what? You fucking tie it up with duct tape?
Yes, basically.
That's so crazy. They hammer a piece of metal into the center where the marrow is.
Where the marrow is, yeah.
Motherfucker.
Yeah,
does it endanger the leg? Does it?
Apparently not. Apparently
not. That's incredible.
It's good stuff.
And then the body just absorbs the titanium? Or
becomes part of the body. Bone tissue forms around as well, and you're all set.
And mates to it, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow, that's incredible.
So I'm you know, pleasantly surprised by the way that this has turned out. I thought I'm here in America now. I thought I would have to take sticks with me on this trip, but I haven't had to do so.
So you planned on taking sticks?
I did, but in the end, I decided not to.
It's incredible. You're just walking around, totally normal. I don't want to. I have knee screws in both knees. I don't know why I'm so surprised, but I for whatever reason, a hip replacement seems like incredible.
Yeah, it's kind of intimate as well. You know, it's right in the center of your being. There, it's kind of.
It's right next to your junk. That's what you're saying.
Right next to your junk. Yeah.
I mean, it's incredibly intimate. It feels, you know, that's what it is. There's a vulnerability. It's inches away from your penis, and they're sawing.
Yeah.
You know?
Plus, Jesus. Plus, I mean, since we're in the business of revelations here, they have to. The other thing that they have to do when you have the surgery for the 24 hours after the surgery is you have to have a catheter. You know. Through the penis and into the bladder, because for those first 24 hours you cannot get up out of bed and you can't lift up to use a bedpan. So, so they stick in a catheter.
And
I felt I wanted that out as soon as possible. I wanted it out as soon as possible. I wanted to return to autonomy over my body as quickly as possible. I did not want it to be subject to the whims or fancies of others. And I made a big fuss about this. I wanted the catheter out the next morning, and they said, and I literally was up on a Zimmer frame by midday the next day, and hobbling to the toilet.
Wow. So how many days was it before you could walk?
So I was walking the very next day on a Zimmer frame. Yeah, yeah.
And they tell you to do this?
Yeah, you have to get going. You can't just sit there and do nothing. You got to get going. So I walked on a Zimmer frame. Then I walked on two sticks, and then one stick.
How long to one stick?
Oh, I only got rid of the one stick about 10 days ago.
Okay, so it was how long in before you could do one stick?
Let's say 4.5 weeks.
4.5 weeks of just walking around with a cane.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Worth it.
Worth it. I'm very happy that I had it done and that I don't have to suffer the pain because I had severe osteoarthritis. I don't know why. I mean, we all think we're young, you know, but I feel young. I'm 62, and I don't know why I was afflicted with this at an age. Most people who go for hip replacement, they're into their 70s, you know. So I don't know why it hit me so hard. I like the line from Raiders of the Lost Ark, you know, where Indiana Jones is all beat up, sitting in the ship's cabin, and in some cabin, and the lady with him comments on his appearance, you know, and he says, "It's not the years, it's the mileage." And I think I put on some mileage over the years.
Well, I know a lot of martial artists that get hip replacements. Yes. Mark Coleman, the former UFC heavyweight champion, just tweeted that he's going in for a hip replacement. Actually, he's already done it. And
okay.
I believe Chuck Norris has had hip replacements. Right. It's very common.
All the impacts. Yeah.
And I have a buddy, my friend Shuki, who's a Muay Thai instructor. I believe he was in line for a hip replacement the last time I saw him. It's a weird joint. Sometimes
Weird joint. But the good news is it's doable.
Mm-hmm.
And after a few weeks of pain and discomfort, you're back on your feet and fully functional. Unless the surgeon screws up, which they do sometimes.
I wonder about guys like Bo Jackson. He was a football player that was injured really badly, and he had to get a hip replacement, and it basically ended his career.
Right.
He was playing football and baseball at the same time. He was a super athlete, incredible athlete. But if they could have fixed him with this back then, it seems like he could have continued playing football.
Probably could have carried on.
That's insane.
Yeah.
Football with an artificial hip. But why should I be shocked? You know, I mean, we have metal tubes that fly to other countries. Why should I be shocked that they can fix your hip?
And what that comes down to is where your quality of life has deteriorated because of pain and immobility, you can recapture that. You can get your quality of life back. And that's what I value about it.
That's another place where cannabis is a beautiful drug. When you're injured, you know, to just give you a sense of ease of your body.
Yeah.
It's for people that are in pain, you know, people have back problems.
Cannabis is a wonderful sort of thing.
It relaxes things.
I have to say that I did wonder, and I still do wonder, whether the fact that I quit cannabis in October 2011 and started feeling severe hip pain just 3 months later in the early part of 2012, whether there's some connection or whether the cannabis was either in some way protecting me from the onset of severe osteoarthritis, or whether at least it was reducing my sensitivity to the pain of the osteoarthritis, because that's when I started noticing it.
So your body was just out of alignment? The hip was out of socket or something? It was wearing in a funny way?
Yeah, it was wearing in a funny way. It seemed that that ball socket joint was not quite the right shape, and you know.
Oh, it's just a natural
some kind of natural thing.
When you talked about the ayahuasca experience and you talked about the goddess coming to you and that you choose to believe that it's real, my thoughts on this whole what is real and what is not real thing, what I've been thinking lately is that it doesn't really even matter.
Yeah.
Because what it is it's about the experience itself. And the best parts of psychedelic experiences are the learning parts. It sounds like so boring to people because they think like, oh no, I thought I was going to see amazing things and I was going to watch elephants fly and it was going to be, you know, mad hallucinations, which does occur sometimes, but that's not what it's really about. What it's really about is about a learning experience. It's about massive leaps in development of your personality and your psyche, your worldview, your personal view. And these massive leaps that happen through psychedelics, they happen exactly the same way if you really do encounter a goddess or if this goddess is just conjured up by your imagination in incredibly vivid detail. Either one is the same experience to you personally.
Yeah. I think that's a very important point.
It's a very important point because, yes, it might be a hallucination, but it is immensely beneficial. Or it might not be a hallucination, and we might not have a full account of what the fuck goes on in the human consciousness, especially during altered states.
Absolutely.
And to go one way or the other, I think, is absurd. Mm-hmm.
We don't need to do that.
We don't need to. We don't know.
Here is an incredibly valuable experience.
Yes,
which is available to us, and which let's not forget that humanity has had a long relationship with these plants. This is one of the problems, again, caused by the war on drugs, mm-hmm. which is that it sought to intervene in that relationship and demonize and make it dangerous to use them, because you might get sent to prison. You can get sent to prison for a very long time. People live in fear. What we need is a nurturing society which makes it possible for people to have these experiences in the safest, most loving environment. The love mm. is love is key. If you're feeling threatened in your head at a particular time, if you're in a space that is uncomfortable or difficult for you, the chances are the psychedelic experience will also be uncomfortable and difficult. The more that you can control the space, the more that you can be surrounded by others who love you and have your best interests at heart, the more likely you are to have a very beneficial experience from that. And those beneficial experiences can and frequently do include painful moments when you come to realization of actually who you are and what you are. And this is it's absolutely fundamental with ayahuasca, is what I call the life review, where you see the impact of your behavior on others, which previously you had insulated yourself from. And when you see the pain you'd caused, you might have felt perfectly justified at the time. When you see it, and you see it with that clarity, it makes you strongly motivated not to do that again.
Yeah.
So it's a very important learning experience. They call them plant teachers. They call them teachers in the Amazon.
That aspect, that learning from your past mistake aspects, exists in a lot of psychedelics. It's a core factor.
I would say it's a core factor of all psychedelics.
And I always felt like it's really ironic that law enforcement works against psychedelics, because nothing would benefit law enforcement more than psychedelics.
Absolutely.
If psychedelics were legal, there'd be so many less crimes.
So many less crimes. First
of all, the drug crimes be out the door, and then it would be a matter of how many people are on mushrooms are going to rob your house. How about zero?
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
They would ask you for food if they were that starving.
Yeah,
I just think that we have this incredible ally that our culture, our society, we have this amazing plant thing that we've discovered in several different forms.
Yeah.
And we've made all of them outside of our reach. We put all of them outside legal reach, which is insane. It's insane.
Yeah, it makes you wonder what's going on. I mean, why is society on this self-destructive trip right now?
They're ignorant. It's essentially, this is, I believe, and this is, it sounds crazy, but I believe this. Mm. I believe that psychedelics are here for human beings to take to move to the next level of consciousness. And they can elevate us away from our warlike ways.
I'm with you on that.
I think it's the only thing. Mm-hmm. The only thing. I don't think ideology, morality shifts with understanding, with the exchange of information. I think morality escalates slowly but surely all throughout culture. Mm-hmm. And eventually, we may get to a term or a time in the future where we're not warlike at all.
Yeah.
But the best way to do that is through psychedelics.
Psychedelics can help,
The people who are involved in the running of things most likely are ignorant to the experience.
Mm.
And so what you're dealing with is someone who is 50, 60 years into a lifelong, closed-off ego trip of death and destruction, and they're the ones that are running the world.
Unfortunately, they're the ones that are running the world.
That's why we're so fucked. We're not so fucked because humans are evil. And when you look around at all the nice people that you meet, you get really confused as to how the world can be so fucked
up.
How
can it be so fucked up?
Because they...
When people are basically good.
Yeah, most people are good. But the people that are running shit, most of them are not good.
And they get like into personality types. Like, I mean, if you want to run shit, then right there, you've got a certain kind of personality.
Yeah, anybody that wants to be president should not be allowed to be president.
Exactly. That should be an instant disqualification.
Yes.
You know, you should be absolutely not wanting that job.
It should be like the lottery, you know? Yeah. Like, you should, like the public, like a new president comes in every month, you know?
Yeah.
And if you do a good job, you know, you get to keep, people get to vote whether they keep you for a few months.
Yeah.
And it's just a person.
Yeah.
Just you have random qualifications as far as education,
absolutely,
as far as your background.
Not some power-hungry egomaniac who wants to push you around, which is unfortunately the case.
And the old boy network, the thing that comes into place when these guys, they're cronies, and they all help each other out and hook each other up and communicate with each other. And then there's lobbyists and special interest groups.
Yeah.
And they all want to make sure that this keeps going, so they make sure that the laws continue to stay on the books, that allow them to do all the stupidity, especially when, like, Congress can't be guilty of insider trading.
Right.
Have you seen that?
I didn't see that.
No. Let me Google that, because I want to make sure that I'm correct. Congress not guilty of insider trading. I think you can't accuse them of insider trading.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, oh, dear is the right way to say that. Let me Google that to make sure that that's true. Congress.
So basically they get immunity?
Yeah. Hold on. I wrote it the wrong. Can't be guilty. Immune to insider trading? Let's try immune. Yeah, there's something. I'm looking at some articles on this here.
Well, politicians are always cutting themselves all the slack there is, you know.
That is exactly what it is. Congress believes they're immune to insider trading laws, and there are legal professors that are debating them. The legal analysis by law professor Donna Nagley of the Indiana University suggests that members of Congress may not be immune to insider trading laws after all. Apparently, there's a 60 Minutes piece where they went on about this. So it's one of those legal things where apparently there's probably you have to go over it with a fine-tooth comb and then find out what exactly the how it's written. It's all craziness.
Bunch of corrupt bastards.
Fucks.
You know, that's it. They want to do that job because they like controlling other people.
But just the fact that they can say that they don't want to be prosecuted for insider trading. It's like, why is that? How much are you doing? How much insider? Guess what? You can come to me all day and you say, hey, Joe, do you think that insider trading should be illegal? And I'll say yes.
Yeah.
And if I do insider trading, prosecute me.
Yeah.
But if I'm coming out saying I don't want you to prosecute me for insider trading.
You definitely got something to hide.
Yeah, you
got to
be like, what the fuck are you doing, man?
Yeah.
That's why you want to be a congressman, so you can just profit off of the stock market, you creep.
So I thought, and I've made this proposal several times, that what I would like to see is anybody running for high office, they first right off, they got to do 10 ayahuasca sessions.
It's a great idea.
You know, that's it. That's the first hurdle. They got to do that. They got to go through it, and we'll see how they feel afterwards. Could be 10, you know, strong mushroom sessions. That would be just as good. But they gotta be able to do that.
You know what's really crazy? The solution exists to a better world. Mm-hmm. It exists. It exists right here. It's not like imagine if some benevolent race from another planet came down here and gifted us with some space fruit. Yeah. And if we eat the space fruit, we'll see ourselves for who we truly are
right
and we'll recognize
in that concept
our potential.
Which many people hold, they're letting go of their responsibility for their own lives. You know?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, but if you told people that you would go, wow, that would be great, but it's science fiction.
Yeah.
Well, the exact thing exists with ayahuasca, psychedelic mushrooms.
That's true.
It exists. Yeah. And for whatever reason, you know, discussing it is a very controversial thing.
Very controversial.
It's very controversial. Like, I've had producers like ask me like, why are you talking about TV shows that I'm working on? Why are you talking about illegal drugs? I'm like,
I've been asked to stay away from those subjects.
Of course, don't talk. You're gonna fuck up this whole thing. Yeah. This ancient archaeology. I think you're onto something, Graham. I think you've done some good work. But leave the mushrooms out, buddy.
Exactly.
Come on.
I've had that conversation.
Come on, Graham. You don't need the mushrooms. We're making some money over here, Graham.
Yeah.
Yeah, it exists.
And I think that was part of the problem with my TED talk, too.
Yeah, we could live in a Narnia world. We could live in a world like Avatar. If everybody was doing ayahuasca, we could pull this world together with a rapid quickness.
Yeah.
If they just broke out ayahuasca ceremonies all over the globe, if it became the next big thing, sort of like cell phones, everybody's got ayahuasca ceremonies on every corner, you could change the whole world within our lifetime in an astounding, loving way where people would abandon so many of their ideas about business and so many of their ideas about controlling resources and killing people. And
you know, the amazing thing is that it is actually happening. It is actually happening, admittedly on a small scale. But for me, this is one of the mysteries of ayahuasca at a time when the Amazon jungle is under such terrible threat. That out of the jungle emerged these two plants, one of which is a vine, you know, which then begins to spread her tentacles all around the planet and to call out to people. And people are drawn to ayahuasca. I can't tell you how often I get asked, where do I go for a good ayahuasca ceremony where I know I can trust the shaman? Again and again, it's happening everywhere. It's happening in Japan. It's happening in America. It's happening in Germany. It's happening all over the world. And so you get a small but growing group of initiates who have had this shared experience, and you know, we kind of know each other when we meet.
And the initiates that have had this experience are talking about it, and more are coming.
Exactly,
it's building and building. And the ayahuasca tourism in South America is gigantic now. So it's really
gigantic. And I a number of times I stand up at and I'm giving a presentation somewhere. And I'm talking about ayahuasca, and then somebody stands up in the audience and says, don't you realize that by promoting ayahuasca, you're leading to the depletion of the rainforest? Quite the opposite is the case. What's happened with ayahuasca is that ayahuasca is being massively planted in the rainforest now because of ayahuasca tourism. Ayahuasca tourism is a really good thing for ayahuasca. It's not causing any depletion, and ayahuasca can be grown in many different parts of the world, and it is being grown. That's the vine.
It's a fascinating subject. The fact that something does exist to give you that experience.
Yeah.
I've always said about the DMT experience that, like, if you could just show someone like what you see, without taking it, they would want to do it. They would want to go, wait a minute, and it doesn't hurt you? Like, no, it doesn't hurt you. You're not going to get hurt.
Mm.
But most people probably shouldn't do it, though. That's what I think. Also,
well, I think even
if baby
we...
steps.
Yeah, if we lived in that ideal world where we as adults had the right to make sovereign decisions about our own consciousness, I think most people wouldn't choose to do it.
Yeah, I think you're right. Well, if you look at how it is in Holland, where marijuana is essentially legal, and nobody, you know, they look down upon people that get high all the time, and they also look down upon hard drugs.
Yeah.
Because of the fact that you can get most things, they understand with great clarity what's dangerous and what's not dangerous.
Yeah, yeah.
And people are always going to make bad mistakes.
That's it. You know, you just have to treat people as adults,
and
you have to understand that some people will make mistakes, and there will be problems. But that should not be an obstacle to what has to be a fundamental freedom.
But what about allowing people into your community that sell them? Allowing people in your community of friends and neighbors that profit off of the addiction of others? Because there's certain drugs like meth.
I agree.
Like, I'm not saying that meth should be illegal. Like, I don't know whether or not. I don't know whether or not there's a way to handle it where you get the maximum benefit. I don't know whether it's making it illegal, decriminalizing it, making it so that people can't get prosecuted for using, but they can get prosecuted for selling.
It's a complicated area.
Yeah.
Some of these substances are very harmful. Personally, I don't want to smoke meth.
But if you were next door to a meth guy, like, you would not want that guy in your community. He's profiting off of enslaving people, chemically enslaving people.
Yeah. So this is an area where more work has to be done. But I think if we approach the problem from a spirit of love and from a spirit of respect for the sovereignty of other adults, it'll be a whole lot better than the way we're approaching the problem right now. And as we know, making these toxic substances illegal doesn't prevent their use. It absolutely does not prevent their use. The use has gone up and up and up and up and up over the decades.
And it's kind of unique. One of the properties of psychedelics, whether it's ibogaine has a great result for curing addictions, and ayahuasca has a great result. And the people that are doing these very things and selling these very drugs, both participating in both sides, selling and dealing, could both benefit from ayahuasca.
Sure.
Like, if you're a meth dealer, you're an asshole.
Yeah.
Like, what an asshole. You're selling something that fucking kills people, makes them pull their skin off of their face.
Yeah.
What are you doing?
One of the first ayahuasca sessions that I went to in Brazil, there was a guy there from L.A. who was a heavy smoker of crystal meth.
Oh, Jesus.
And he came there in a state, he was just so wired. And it came out as we were discussing, as we were talking, it came out that he had a rival in love, and he'd gone out and got a gun, and just before he left L.A., the best decision he ever made was to leave L.A. and come down to Brazil and drink ayahuasca. He was getting close to the point of murdering a fellow human being.
Wow.
2 weeks in Brazil, 5 ayahuasca sessions, completely turned him around, and he revolutionized his life.
It's incredible.
And he became such a loving, positive, warm-spirited person, and all his anger was gone, and he moved on in his life in amazing ways. And I've seen many, 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 many examples of that. I don't want to pretend, however, that it's all sweetness and light in the garden. There are problems also with ayahuasca, and people should be aware of this. There are shamans who are abusing their power. There are, you know, if you go to a place like Iquitos in Peru, you'll find there's two types of shamans. One type are the curanderos, they're the healers. The other type are the brujos, they're sorcerers, actually. And they will use ayahuasca to gain power over others. And there have been one or two horrendous cases that occur with this. So I do think the intention of the individuals who are involved is also an important part of this. And psychedelics, I agree with you that the single one-stop shop to transform our society and make it a better place, a far better place than it can be today, is the correct use of psychedelics. But I would be wrong to say that psychedelics are a magic potion, because they're not. And there have been societies which have misused psychedelics profoundly. I would say that the Aztecs in Mexico were one of those.
What did they do?
Well, they used psilocybin, but they did not use it for gentle consciousness exploration. The Aztecs used psilocybin preparatory to rituals of human sacrifice. The Aztecs used psilocybin as a vehicle to communicate with their deities, and those deities included characters like Huitzilopochtli, who was the war god, who spoke to Moctezuma, was the last Aztec emperor, and that's 1519. When Cortez appears in Mexico. And Moctezuma was in daily communication with the war god by means of psilocybin mushrooms. And what the war god was telling him to do, you know, there's demons out there as well as angels. What the war god was telling him to do was to kill people and to stretch them over a stone and cut out their hearts. And there was a horrendous situation in Tenochtitlan, which was the capital city, which is now Mexico City, as a matter of fact, when they inaugurated the Great Pyramid. Reliable accounts, 80,000 people were sacrificed to the god of war.
In 4 days.
80,000 people. Now, this is a bloody awful thing that was going on there, and psychedelics were involved. I'm not saying that psychedelics caused it. And again, we come to this issue. Are these entities that we encounter projections of our own minds? Or is there some other realm or level of existence where non-physical entities that communicate with us at the level of consciousness exist? Whichever it is, whether it's a projection of our own minds, as you rightly say, or whether those entities are real, is less important than the effects on our behavior. But if what is being projected from our own mind is very dark and negative and wicked, or if those entities also include evil angels as well as good guys, then you can get cultures misled down this path. And I do believe that's what happened with the Aztecs. There's also recently, and again, I think truth is really important. Truth is really important. So let's be truthful about this also. There have been some tragic cases with ayahuasca, most recently in Chile, which actually involved a human sacrifice, which actually involved the burning to death of a baby on the instructions of the so-called guru or shaman, who he'd formed a kind of death cult, but their sacrament was ayahuasca. This is very rare, but it does happen. And I think people should be aware when they enter ayahuasca space that one of the things ayahuasca does is it makes you more suggestible. It opens your heart. If a powerful, strong, negative personality comes along and says to you, do this, do this, do this, do this, do this, you might just do it. And that is also there possible. So you have to be strong in yourself. You have to be clear on your intent. And if you're not going into this with good intent, then bad things also can happen.
Well, I would also wonder, what would it be like to introduce psychedelics into the insane warlike environment of Aztec Mexico in the 1500s? I mean, what would it have been like this living back then? And what would it take to become a person of royalty, an emperor, a king? In those days, it was insane bloodshed.
Insane bloodshed.
There's war.
They were a very dark and demonic culture, and unfortunately, that demonic aspect of Aztec culture was, without any shadow of a doubt, mediated by psilocybin mushrooms, and they called them teonanactil, which means the flesh of the gods, and they were used for communication with demonic entities, and we cannot pretend that that was not so. Mm-hmm. This was the case, and indeed, if the Aztecs had not been those people who murdered their neighbors, who used their neighbors as a sort of farm. I mean, if you imagine a society which was run by serial killers, and right. in the interests of serial killers. That's roughly Aztec society in 1519. So they would have neighboring tribes who they would prey on. They could easily have completely defeated them, but they preferred not to completely defeat them. They preferred to use them for warfare every year, make war on them, take captives, bring the captives back to Tenochtitlan, and cut out their hearts. And this is why there's karma. There's such a thing as karma. Where this is why Montezuma was brought down. I mean, 490 Spaniards turn up on the coast of Mexico and destroy a standing army of 200,000 men. Why does that happen? It happened because the neighbors of the Aztecs hated the Aztecs. They utterly hated them. And they were looking for liberation from that horror that was being inflicted on
them. Well, isn't that a better... I shouldn't say a better, but... isn't a possibility that what you're dealing with is a bunch of sociopaths and a bunch of crazy people. And if you introduce psilocybin into mm-hmm. their system mm-hmm. in this insane warlike world, mm-hmm. that what you're conjuring up is their imagination.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
is the desire to manifest these yeah. things yeah. that would ask them to do horrible things.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is a core behavior pattern in human beings when they get in control of armies.
Yes, yeah, it is. Yeah.
Absolute, complete, total ruthlessness, barbaric behavior is not only is it beneficial, but it's necessary.
It's applauded.
Yeah, it's applauded.
And
it's necessary.
And it wins you medals.
And if you don't do it, someone around you is going to do it, so you have
yeah.
to do it.
Yeah. So there's the interesting question right there. I mean, we right. have armies now in the world today, mm-hmm. which are going out doing murderous stuff,
right?
And so the question is, if we were to be in such a position that we could massively introduce psychedelics into those armies, would it actually make them worse or better? I'm not sure what the answer is. You know, I'm not sure what.
It's very honest of you to not be sure, and that is the. I think there's no way to be sure. We know that the Vikings they berserkered on mushrooms.
They were using,
was it Amanita muscaria?
Amanita
they took?
Muscaria, yeah.
Yeah. I never had much luck with that.
Me neither.
Yeah, that's what I hear from a lot of people.
Me neither. So
it felt weird.
If you want to have luck with it, you've got to pass it through
urine.
You've got to pass it through a reindeer or through the bladder of a shaman.
Yeah.
Then it'll work, you know.
Oh, how convenient. You have to drink shaman piss.
Yes.
Yeah, that's the thing that they always say. You have to recycle your urine. I'm like,
it's as though the body functions as a filter.
Yeah.
And it removes certain impurities, which then allow the good stuff to remain, and that comes through in urine. And apparently you can pass it through 7 human bodies. It doesn't lose.
Hey, easy. I know a buddy who did it. He was on mushrooms, and they told him to drink his urine. He's like, I am so high right now. I do not need to drink my urine. And they're like, trust me, drink your urine. And he said he drank his urine. It was like just getting shot through a cyclone.
Right.
Boom! He said the whole thing just took some incredible path from drinking his own urine.
Yeah, I must say that's not an experience I've had or would welcome, but that's what the research shows.
I have drunk my own urine on several occasions.
Have you?
Yeah, just to see. Because I read about urine therapy, so I wanted to find out what it was about.
It's like, a big thing in India.
Does it really make you feel better when you're sick? Yeah. And it did work, but it might have been placebo. Yeah. I don't know. But there was one time when I was sick, and I took it. I called my friend Jan up, and I'm like, dude, I drank my own piss, and it worked. It was crazy because he was like big on it, you know, big on urine therapy.
Does it taste okay?
Stuff. It doesn't taste nearly as bad as you would think it tastes.
Okay.
The idea is a lot worse than the actual reality of
right.
the urine.
Yeah, the idea is hard to grasp.
Yeah, but it's just like warm water. Okay. It's not horrific tasting.
Okay.
You gag a little when you smell it. You're like, I can't believe I'm going to drink this. But once you're actually drinking it, it's not that big a deal. I haven't done it in a long time. I don't want to say, like Lyoto Machida, who's a famous UFC fighter, he drinks his own urine every morning.
Okay.
And there's another guy, Juan Manuel Marquez, a famous boxer from Mexico. Same thing.
Yeah.
Was drinking his own. I think he quit. He gave up.
If you're
going
to do that, you might as well have some Amanita muscaria in there.
Yeah, you might as well. And even then, yeah. I wonder if when a person goes completely psycho, when you're living in war, and one of the things about the Mexicans, the Aztecs, rather, is I don't even think they had horses yet.
No, they didn't. This is one of the reasons, why a relatively small force of Spaniards were able to defeat them.
Yeah.
Was because the horse had been extinct in the Americas for 12,000 years.
Wow.
From the end of the last ice age. And so when the Spanish turned up with actually only 16 horses, 16 heavy hunters that were trained for warfare, European armies had had thousands of years to develop strategies to deal with men on horseback. Uh-huh. And there were definite specific tactics and responses that you used when you were charged. But the Maya and the Aztecs, they had no idea what they were looking at. They actually, if you look at their accounts, which I've done, you'll find that they initially thought that they were dealing with supernatural beings, which were part deer, actually, because that was the nearest animal that they could relate to a horse, part deer and part human. And they didn't know how to handle these things. And they, you know, they're coming down at you at 25 or 30 miles an hour. They're covered in armor, the horse and the man, and it's a pretty terrifying prospect. And they broke armies of tens of thousands of men, were just fled in terror at the sight of these entities charging down on them. Eventually they learned, and there's a famous case that one of the tribes in Mexico that fought most vigorously against Montezuma were a people called the Tlaxcalans. He used them for human sacrifice. They're very independent, spirited people, great warriors. And you would have thought when the Spanish came into Mexico that the first people who would become their allies would be the Tlaxcalans. But in fact, the Tlaxcalans had a heroic character called Xicotenca, who was their battle king. And he saw the future, and he saw what Spain would eventually do to Mexico. And so initially, and very hard, he fought the Spanish tooth and nail for over a long campaign that lasted about 6 weeks. And during that campaign, on one occasion, one of his warriors actually took the head off a horse with a single blow of their weapon, which was a bit like a sword. It was made of wood. It was called a macuahuitl, and it had flakes of obsidian lined along the edges of the blade. And that horse was not wearing armor that day, and a horse was beheaded, shocked the Spanish. It was the first time suddenly there was proof for the people in front of them that these animals were not supernatural, that they could be killed. But eventually, you know, Cortez was a terrorist. He went around massacring whole villages. He burned people at the stake. He fed people to dogs. And eventually the Tlaxcalans did the calculation, and they said, we better join this guy rather than carry on with this. And so eventually they did join forces with him, and suddenly he had 100,000 auxiliaries who were ready to take Moctezuma on.
Jesus Christ. Can you imagine living back then?
Extraordinary times.
Strange
And
times.
I have to say, although I really detest a lot of the things that the Spanish did, I have to say, those 490 men, they had balls of steel. You know, they had balls of steel. I mean, to turn up on this distant coast with no resources, no reserves, nothing to fall back on, and to know that you're confronting an enemy that is a militaristic power that has hundreds of thousands of men under arms, that sacrifices you if it catches you, and still to go for it, that takes tremendous courage. Cortes actually scuttled all his ships so that his men could not flee. The ships were scuttled.
What does that mean, scuttled?
Sunk. He sunk them.
Put holes in them?
Yeah. He put holes in them and sunk them. And,
oh, gangster.
And then he said, this is it. There's no going back.
Jesus Christ.
We conquer, or we die.
What a fucking psycho.
Yeah, so total psycho. So it's been interesting for me, because this is my latest writing effort has been a novel about the Spanish conquest of Mexico. These days I do novels as well as nonfiction. It's been interesting for me to get inside the head of a man like Cortez, to get inside the head of a man like Moctezuma, and to figure out what drove them and what made these characters what they were. And I have a witch in the story, a young Aztec witch, and I have a famous woman called Malinal, who became Cortez's lover, who had a grudge against Montezuma. History doesn't tell us why, but I give her a motive in the story, because he tried to sacrifice.
That's kind of cool that you could do that with history.
You can do that with history, and you can do that with fiction. And so She's a key player in not just in my story, but in the story of history, because she became Cortés' interpreter. She was very clever. She learned Spanish very, very fast. And she would be... So in the paintings from those days, you always see her standing beside Cortés, and coming out of her mouth is the glyph that means speech. And she gave the whole story away to Cortés. She told Cortés how to defeat Moctezuma, and that was to play on the myth of Quetzalcoatl, of the feathered serpent, who would return and bring in a new age and overthrow a wicked king. And she had Cortez fill the boots of Quetzalcoatl.
Wow. How did you get so involved in the Aztec culture? It's so fascinating.
When I was
researching, it's almost impossible to avoid once it starts.
This is the book, by the way.
War God.
War God, yeah. This is it. When I was researching Fingerprints of the Gods back in the early 90s, I traveled extensively and widely in Mexico as part of my research, because Mexico is a fascinating place from the point of view of a lost civilization. You know, we have the Olmec culture. We have these those gigantic stone heads from a site that's thought to be 3,500 years old. I think it's probably much older than that, on the Gulf of Mexico. Heads in the form of African heads, which is very puzzling and weird, but also images of people with very strongly Caucasian features, with massive beards and definitely not American Indian faces. And there they are. So I was wondering, are these the remnants of some lost civilization? Because history does not explain how individuals with that appearance ever turned up in Mexico. And I inadvertently, as I was researching Fingerprints of the Gods in Mexico, I inadvertently traveled the route of Cortez. And I found myself again and again crossing the path that Cortez had taken from the Gulf of Mexico up to what is now Mexico City. And I began to realize there was a fascinating story to tell here, and a story that had never been properly told. And I used the accounts of some of the conquistadors, men like Bernal Diaz, who give us eyewitness accounts of Aztec society. This helped me to understand, because the Aztecs were latecomers in the civilization of Mexico, but they'd only existed as an empire for 200 years before Cortez came. But they revered earlier cultures, and particularly the amazing pyramid site of Teotihuacan, 30 miles north of Mexico City, which means the place where men became gods. So I was investigating the possibility of a lost civilization, but I was kind of imbibing the story of Cortez and of the Aztecs at the same time. And I felt this kind of pall of sadness that hangs over Mexico, this feeling that something terrible happened there.
Really?
And what's at the heart of my story, without giving too much of it away, is this notion of demonic influence that Montezuma, and I accept it could be projection of the individual's mind because he's just a particularly wicked, evil individual, or it could be that there are real demons out there. So Montezuma is communicated with and advised by Huitzilopochtli, the war god, and Cortez is well known, had believed he had a special relationship with St. Peter, and he in dreams encountered St. Peter, and St. Peter advised him to carry out some of the most horrific acts of genocide that have been ever recorded in the history of the Americas. And so the speculation of the novel is that both the entity that appeared to Montezuma as the war god and the entity that appeared to Cortez as St. Peter were actually one and the same demonic entity, seeking to multiply human misery, because that's what demons do. And if we think it was bad under the Aztecs, let's be honest and accept that it was 1,000 times worse after the Spanish took over. The population of Mexico was calculated to be 30 million in 1519. Within 40 years, it was 1 million. 29 million people died. Gigantic, horrendous genocide. And the Spanish were monsters. They would use people to test the edge of their weapons. Let's just see if we can chop off somebody's arm here. Let's see what this axe will do. Oh, the dogs are hungry. Let's just throw a bunch of people to the dogs. That's where the phrase throwing them to the dogs comes from, as a matter of fact. So wow. they were awful people. And it's been a dark story to write, but I've also found that in this world, in this realm at that time, there was the capacity for love. There were decent people who did their best.
My dad is a pretty sensible guy. He's never for weirdness or spiritual shit. He's just not that kind of guy. But he was telling me about going to Gettysburg.
Yeah.
And he said
that was a horrendous battle.
He said he could feel sadness in the air. Mm-hmm. He said it was inescapable. It was overwhelming.
Yeah.
And he said, I just didn't expect that. He said, you know, I don't know what it is. I don't know what it is. Maybe it's the knowledge of what happened there. He goes, but I don't think so. It was in the air.
Permeates the atmosphere.
And you felt that?
I felt that very strongly, that there was this terrible, terrible sadness hanging over Mexico. I was always high.
Could have been that, right?
Yeah,
Were you high in Mexico, you fucking gangster?
Yeah, I got high in Mexico.
God damn, that's dangerous.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you about this because there's a guy on my message board. His name is Frodo Swaggins, and he sent me a cool link to this new thing that's been found under Teotihuacan. Mm-hmm. They found a jade mask from an earlier era and some building, some work underneath there that they're investigating now that they believe was Olmec.
Yeah, doesn't surprise me at all. I think we're going to find that Teotihuacan actually goes way back, not just to the beginnings of the historical epoch, but far deep into prehistory. And the Olmec, the so-called Olmecs of Central America, may go back 10, 12,000 years. They may not be, I don't think we should just limit them to the last 3,500 years. So this is the case with many of these sites. It's the same, by the way, if you go to Chichen Itza. If you can get inside the pyramid of Kukulcan at Chichen Itza, and Kukulcan is just another name for Quetzalcoatl, you'll find that it's built on top of another pyramid, which is inside it, an older pyramid, and preserved completely inside it. And you can even get inside that older pyramid. And I think it's the case all over the world that sites have been built on top of older sites, reincarnated in a way. So there was an ancient sacred place, and later cultures came along and honored it and built new monuments on top of it. But the mistake the archaeologists make is that the origins of the site are the later culture, and they don't take account of the earlier culture.
Well, that was one of the things that John Anthony West was suggesting about Egypt, when you show the very different construction methods that coincidentally are below the ground. Yes. Like, you have to dig out the sand to pull these things up, and oh, lo and behold, they look different.
Yeah, and that's like the Osirion at in Abydos in Upper Egypt, which is 50 or 60 feet lower than the Temple of Seti I, and was actually covered with 50 feet of sedimentation until archaeologists dug it out, but they still insist on giving it to Seti I, you know.
It's a fascinating thing, the denialism that's involved in Egyptology.
It is.
That Zawi Hawass dude is a trip just to watch him talk about things. You're like, how are you in control of how this thing gets labeled or discovered or researched?
It's an extraordinary thing, Zahi's rise to power and then his subsequent fall.
Isn't he in trouble now? Is he in jail?
He's in deep shit.
Is he going to jail?
Almost.
What did
certainly.
He do?
He's
corruption?
Under house arrest. His main thing was that he was closely associated with the Mubarak family, particularly with Susan Mubarak, the wife of the deposed president, Hosni Mubarak.
Uh-huh.
And they protected him so he could do whatever he liked while Mubarak was running Egypt. And therefore, he was one of the closest to Mubarak in the Egyptian regime. So when Mubarak fell and a whole new system came into play in Egypt, Zahi was one of the first to go.
It was shocking, the John Anthony West series, Magical Egypt, is one of my favorite DVD series.
And John
ever.
Is such a brilliant human being, and
he's awesome.
Devoted his life to exploring the mystery of Egypt and the magic of Egypt. This is what archaeologists never do.
And if he's listening, I owe you an email, dude. I swear to God, I'm going to email you back quick. I've just been crazy busy. He's getting.
I had an email exchange with John today.
I've been so swamped with this new TV show that I'm doing that I'm behind on everything, text messages and emails and all that. But I'm a big fan of that guy's work, and that Magical Egypt thing is just one of the most stunning documentary series I've ever watched. It's like 10 DVDs or something like that. It's an immense amount of work.
That's right, and incorporating John's just vast encyclopedic knowledge of the mysteries of Egypt. It's all expressed in there.
Incredible. And
so John is about to be vindicated, I would say. He and Robert Schock from Boston University. This was John's work initially, and Robert Schock became involved in it, which was you'll remember the argument about the Sphinx.
Yes.
The Sphinx bears very characteristic erosion marks, both on its body and on the trench dug around it, and that those are the marks of precipitation-induced weathering, of exposure to thousands of years of heavy rainfall. Cut a long story short, no such rainfall in Egypt in the last 5,000 years. You have to go back 10, 12,000 years, the end of the last ice age, to get that kind of climate. And
then you have to have thousands of years of those conditions to create that kind of erosion.
To get that weathering. So when John Anthony West and Robert Schock dropped this bombshell on Egyptology in roughly 1992, that the Sphinx actually might be thousands of years older than the Egyptologists imagine, there was a huge outcry. And Egyptologists became very, very angry about it because they were threatened in the core of their being. And one of the arguments they made, which they thought was the killer argument, was, look, you're saying this monument is 12,000 years old, but there are no other large monuments anywhere in the world which are 12,000 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Well, unfortunately for the Egyptologists, that's no longer true, because there's just the most amazing site has been discovered in Turkey called Göbekli Tepe.
Yeah, we talked about the last time you
amazing.
Were on. Incredible site.
And it was deliberately buried by the people who made it.
14,000 years ago.
Well, no, it looks like it was made 12,000 years ago.
12,000.
Deliberately buried 10,000 years ago. And that means that no later culture has tramped over it to confuse the dating record. And therefore, we have a pristine site. And when a site is pristine and it's approached by a mainstream archaeologist such as Klaus Schmidt from the German Archaeological Institute, who's the excavator, he has to honestly put his hand on his heart and say, this site is 12,000 years old. And if Göbekli Tepe is 12,000 years old, then there's no reason on earth why the Sphinx shouldn't be 12,000 years old. And if the Sphinx and Göbekli Tepe are 12,000 years old, then I'm sorry, we have to rewrite the history books.
There was a real weird moment and whatever documentary it was that showed Robert Schoch presenting his findings,
yeah,
because he's an academic and he's the only one that they would allow to present. And
professor of geology at Boston University.
And
yeah.
John Anthony West is not an academic.
Yeah.
He's an Egypt expert. He's
yes.
a guy who's immersed himself in Egypt
correct.
His whole life. But I don't know what his formal education is, but the fact that that guy hasn't been given some sort of at least like someone test him. And give the guy a fucking degree. Because,
yeah.
Who the hell knows more about ancient Egypt than John Anthony West?
Nobody knows more about
and
ancient Egypt.
And it should, obviously, his credentials should be examined. Mm. I mean, his words should be checked.
Yeah.
But I'm sure that he's on.
He's totally on.
I've never heard a single thing about any of his translations, about any of his... that seemed to me anything less than cunty, if they were negative. Like, it didn't make any sense at all. Like,
yeah.
I think he's a pretty astounding person when it comes to his knowledge.
I think John is an astounding person, and I think that he's brought a unique insight to ancient Egypt, and he's done far more for the exploration of the past than any credentialed Egyptologist has ever done.
So now that Göbekli Tepe's been clearly established at least 10,000 years old, that's when it was buried.
12,000 years old, because the best stuff is the oldest.
Right.
10,000 years old, 10,000 years ago, like a time capsule, they bury it.
And by the way, it's only 5% of it has been excavated.
A huge, vast area remaining to be excavated.
So there's who knows what the hell they're going to find under there, whether they're going to find artifacts or what have you that explain things a little bit better. But we know people were capable of doing that then.
Yes.
Now. That's 100%.
And therefore, if they're capable, because some of those megaliths weigh up, one of them weighs 50 tons, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Göbekli Tepe is a stone circle. There's a circle of...
Series of stone circles.
And therefore, we're looking at a culture that 12,000 years ago was already capable of doing that. In other words, we can't say that they just made that up overnight.
Right.
There has to be a long background to that that got them to the point where they could do that. And that is why Göbekli Tepe is the single most important archaeological site in the world, because it could not have appeared by magic. It had to be the result of a culture which had figured out how to work with large and heavy blocks of stone and to quarry them and carve them and move them around. And that our ancestors are supposed to have been hunter-gatherers, you know, living in small groups without any large-scale organization. And Göbekli Tepe gives the lie to that.
And there's a very sophisticated carving method employed on these beams, a three-dimensional carving method, where instead of carving the image into the stone itself, which is the easy way to draw something, they actually left the piece of stone.
Yeah.
Like if they drew a lizard, they would cut away everything else and leave the lizard to stand out.
Exactly.
That's very difficult to do.
Carving in high relief. It's extremely difficult to do, and again, it takes practice. Takes a culture that's worked on that. So we have to say there's a background to this which goes thousands of years earlier than the site that we found. And as more excavation is done, I believe more and more of that is going to come out. So
one of my favorite quotes of yours is that we're a civilization with amnesia.
A species with amnesia.
Amnesia. It's such a great way of putting it. Because when you keep digging holes and finding things that are like old as fuck, like Göbekli Tepe was found by a farmer, right?
Mm-hmm.
He was just putzing around and is like, what the hell is this?
What's
he kicks it, he moves it around. He's like, this is weird.
Yeah.
He starts digging and boom, it's
yeah.
one of the most important archaeological findings ever.
Absolutely.
But none of this existed while you guys were dealing with Zalihuas.
No.
I was watching that, and the other thing was the other academic who he was communicating with, whatever that guy's name is, no need to even say it, such a cunty human being. The way he was laughing, like, what culture are we talking about that existed 10,000 years
ago?
why is that funny to you?
Let him remain nameless.
Yeah.
I know who you mean.
Let him remain nameless.
And they pour scorn on these ideas.
Intellectual scorn.
They're so fucking arrogant. You know,
not all of them, right?
Not all of them.
You know, I mean, most of them are doing amazing things. The reason why you have an incredible hip,
Some
motherfuckers in academia who's...
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm not insulting science as such.
Just humans. Just shitty ego humans.
There's just some shitty ego-driven humans. And it happens that archaeology is one of those areas of study which is very territorial, and where scholars have staked their reputation on a particular view of the past, and they get very angry when anybody threatens that. And they're very, very, very obnoxious to one another as well as to outsiders.
And they've told this story and given degrees based on what they've taught for decades.
Yeah, yeah.
Decades after decades after decades. And to all of a sudden step in and say, we were wrong.
Yeah.
There's no way this guy... You know,
it's very difficult to do. It's very, very difficult to do. And in saying these negative things about Egyptology, I also do want to say that they also do great work. There's a fantastic work has been done by Egyptology. And I don't think that I could have written any of my books if I hadn't been able to draw on the huge amount of data that Egyptology has provided. But sometimes I put a different interpretation on it from the one that they put on it. So I don't want to put them down completely. They've done great work, but they're narrowly focused on a particular reference frame, a particular idea of how human history evolved. And they should let the evidence speak for itself rather than impose that.
And we should point out that there is a small group of people I shouldn't quantify them. There's some people believe that the water erosion feature, it was actually wind and sand.
Yeah.
I've seen that argument, and I'm not a geologist, obviously, but when I saw Robert Schock deal with that argument, it doesn't seem to hold water.
It doesn't hold water. Schock's got an excellent answer to all of that, and it is not. Wind weathering. So it was not sand. Anyway, the Sphinx was covered with sand for a very long period of time.
The way it comes, like, cuts down and in, it looks like water had been pouring down
channels
it for
of
a
water,
long time.
Cutting grooves
smooth
into the rock.
And groovy, like, you know, I mean, I don't know, though. I'm not qualified to...
Well, that's why Schock, you know, has made a marvelous contribution to this whole field, because he is a credentialed academic, he is a geologist, and he's been prepared to put his reputation on the line and say, I'm sorry, I think the Sphinx is really, really old.
Yeah, what bothers me about the people that debunk it is they claim to be correct. The people that look, it's very obvious you're dealing with some pretty significant erosion.
Yeah.
So why is it so different looking than the erosion on the outside of the Sphinx, which looks like wind and sand?
Yeah.
Why are you dealing with it in this enclosure where this thing was buried for so long? Like, why is it different here? Is it the type of stone? Is that what it is?
Yeah.
I mean, what is it? Or is it evidence of an older time?
Yeah.
Is it possibly something that was built into some malleable stone a long fucking time ago? And then pretending that it's not possible is kind of silly.
It's kind of silly.
Because you don't know. We don't have a really accurate map of what happened 10,000 years ago.
How do you know that the history of science is such, we know again and again that fixed and rigid views about how the world is do get overthrown. They do get changed.
But reluctantly in some
reluctantly,
areas.
Reluctantly, with a fight, but eventually the new evidence overwhelms the old. And I think we're, in the realm of ancient history, we're poised on the verge of that kind of revolution. I think it's going to happen.
With Zawi Hawass out of the picture, is it possible now that they can excavate some sites that they weren't allowed to before? Like, I know there was something where they wanted to do something under the paw of the Sphinx. They had found some chamber.
That's a needed project. Which needs to be done. I don't know. I don't know whether the new authorities. Right now, Egypt is just so busy surviving, and so busy, so busy trying to figure out where it goes next. And you know, they've had a major political change, but many of the old guard are still in place in many, many ways. And there is this popular uprising in Egypt, but it's disorganized and unplanned. It's right now the last thing that most Egyptians are thinking about is ancient history.
My take on that part of the world, as a comedian, is that if that's the birthplace of civilization, that's the cradle of civilization, that those people right now, that's the townies of the world.
That's
the people that never left, the people that literally are living like with the echoes of the behavior of people that lived 10,000 years ago in that very same spot.
And well, that's why everything's particular, so... In particular, Egypt's Coptic population, who number out of 60 million, I believe, roughly 6 million, are Copts. So they are practicing a particularly ancient form of Christianity. Their language is structurally very closely related to the ancient Egyptian language, and they are the direct inheritors of the ancient Egyptian tradition. So when ancient Egyptians were converted to Christianity around about 300 or 400 years after Christ, That was the beginning of the Coptic Church in ancient Egypt, and the Coptic people are the true inheritors of the lost wisdom.
Fascinating.
Of ancient Egypt.
And I bet they suck to hang out with. I bet they're really annoying. I bet they've got some crazy rules. They do a lot of weird stuff to their people.
Are they involved in genital manipulation? No, not really.
Who's
they're
doing
persecuted,
that?
They're a persecuted,
oh, persecuted
minority.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah, very, very much so.
6 million of them.
Yeah, but out of 60 million and in an area which is, you know, which is involved with Islamic fundamentalism, very, very much it's difficult to be a minority in that situation.
So what you're saying is it's better to be a Christian in that area?
No, I think that all three of the world's monotheistic faiths, whether it's Christianity, Judaism, or Islam, have been responsible for just a vast amount of misery in the world. And I think we're not going to move on as a human race unless we actually move on from that time, where we don't accept that something is true just because our parents or some guy with a beard tells us that it's true. You know, where we look for direct experience of the spirit and the divine. This is the problem with all of those big religions. I don't care whether they call themselves Christians, Muslims, or Jews, you know, is that they're hierarchies, they're bureaucracies, they're power structures, and they do not offer a direct experience. That's why all of them persecute the use of psychedelics. Mm-hmm. They don't want people to have direct contact with the divine.
Are you hopeful about things when you see, like, Arab Spring, people are rising up and trying to remove dictators, and what happened in Egypt, getting rid of Mubarak?
I am hopeful, and I think it is happening all over the world, and I think the internet has played a part with it, and it's happening in America. I come here as a foreigner. I'm British. I come to America often. I have family here in America. I feel very closely connected with America, and America is a paradox. You know, it's a huge paradox because on the world stage, America is a very dark and malignant force, which does tremendous harm consistently and has done for a long time. But at the individual level, there's a tremendous spirit of awakening in America. Look just what's happening with cannabis laws in America in the last 10 years. That's unimaginable in Britain. We can't make changes like that.
Why is that?
Because we don't have this spirit of independence. We don't have the structure where individual states can make decisions on key issues like that.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, in America, there's a conflict between state law and federal law. You know, the federal government is not always respecting state laws and is seeking to persecute people who are using cannabis. But, you know, I think that in itself, the fact that a number of states have decriminalized or even legalized cannabis, is a sign of a sea change that is underway at the moment. And what it reflects is an awakening of the American people. So even though, you know, huge negative forces are still at work and are still sitting in the seat of power, I think there's a tremendous hope for the future in America, and that comes from the awakening to consciousness of the American people. And maybe it's small right now, but it's growing. And in that sense, far more than any other, I believe America is leading the world, that there is this possibility for awakening here. And maybe it goes back to the, you know, to the founding fathers and the frontier days, and just the sense that people should be able to make decisions about their own lives without government telling them what to do. That's the step we all need to take. We need to move ahead. We need to set aside our commitment to these large monolithic religions. We need to set aside our commitment to large monolithic states. We need to run our own lives and make decisions for ourselves. And it just happens that is very close to the heart of what America is all about.
What it should be all about, instead of what it's all about, is we're living inside of the balls of the dick that's fucking the world.
Yeah.
That's really what it's all about.
But living inside the balls, you're in a position to give that dick that's fucking the world a real pain, you know?
Well, what would be even better is if the dick would just get its shit together.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's not impossible.
Well, it's only going to be done by the American people, by the awakening of the American people, and they will say enough is enough, and we will not accept this crap anymore.
And slowly but surely, the old guard dies off.
And then there's a huge industry of brainwashing, which goes on, makes it difficult for people to think for themselves. You know, it's very
brainwashing. Like how?
Well, through the media. I mean, just through the control. So there's this whole ethic that our lives are supposed to be about production and consumption and nothing else. Mm-hmm. That we define ourselves in terms of what we own. We're prepared to go into huge debt to own a shiny car or, mm-hmm. you know, a better house. And that's supposed to be right and proper. And then we define ourselves in terms of our consumption. And we must work hard. We must go to the office every day. All of these things are brainwashing. And then there's the TV. We can have a little relaxation. We can enjoy some fantasy. Maybe we'll win the lottery one day. All of these are mechanisms of control, which keep people quiet in society.
And distractions from the great beyond. Yeah. It's just there's too much out there to really stop and think about the fact that your body's going to slowly expire, even the sun that heats the world itself is going to die out.
Yeah.
And I think the possibilities, when we really consider them all, are pretty terrifying. So
terrifying.
We watch Storage Wars. You know, do you have Storage Wars?
No.
One of the best shows ever. Not really. It's terrible. But, I mean, it's hilarious. Mm. They go to storage units that people haven't paid for.
Right.
And they open up the door and they find things in there like, whoa, what is this? And they bid on the door. Like there's like 10 people sitting around and they all bid on the contents. And if you get lucky, who knows, there might be gold bullion in there that someone saved.
Right.
Or not.
Right.
And so these idiots go and open up these boxes and then pull shit out. And then it turns out that it's not even really what the contents were. They added fake contents to these storage places.
Right, right.
But people watch it and they just get distracted.
It's a distraction. So if we're going to wake up, we have to overthrow these systems of mental control which are in place.
Right. And or take responsibility for your own time.
You've got to
because
take
those distractions are just they're money extractors. That's what they are.
They're all money extractors.
Yeah, they're selling Tide or Toyota trucks or whatever the hell they're selling.
Yeah.
And you know, they're just putting on this thing cuz it's a machine that they can press and it's like an automatic program that runs and extracts money. It's not really necessarily a work of art. It's just, you know, you've made a hack.
Terrifying prospect, really.
But it does. You don't have to do it. You know, I think what people really need is what sounds crazy, but what people really need is guys like you to talk about things. Mm-hmm. Guys like you to put ideas out there that makes them go, yeah, what am I doing? Yeah, what is this? And what is and start the ball rolling of rethinking their thought process.
Rethinking is badly needed.
It's everything, right?
It's everything, and I do think that something that I bang on about a lot is the issue of sovereignty over consciousness.
Yes,
you know, that is to me just one of the very, very, very key issues, which a lot of people have been persuaded not ever to think about. But once you start thinking about it, and you realize that this mysterious, we don't even know what consciousness is. You know, I mean, there is no clear science on what it is or to explain it, but we know we've got it. And whatever it is, it's the essence of ourselves. And why can we not make sovereign decisions over the most intimate and personal part of ourselves? It's crazy.
Yeah.
And when you, I find when you put that to people, even to arch Republicans, you know, they get it. They suddenly realize, you know, that even that actually legalizing psychedelics is a Republican issue.
I'll tell you what the problem is, Graham Hancock, is the children. What you're ignoring is you're endorsing drug use to children. And I think that's incredibly irresponsible.
That's exactly what Ted said when they banned my talk. One of their statements, they said that we can't allow this talk to be on the air because some young man might go off to South America and drink ayahuasca.
That's so hilariously
dumb. And Ted cannot be seen to be endorsing the drinking of ayahuasca.
Is that there was a huge issue with you. And by the way, your issue was after Eddie Huang came in here.
Very
Eddie Huang
yeah.
told his gross story that makes you just go, ew, Ted.
Yeah.
Apparently John Anthony West has a Ted story as well.
Yeah.
And I think that there's a lot of beautiful things that come out of Ted, a lot of
some
incredible
fantastic talks. Yeah.
But it seems like any organization, once people get into power and once people have the ability to tell other people what's cool and what's not cool, it starts getting weird. And you start telling Eddie Huang that he has to attend all these different things and meet all these donors and
like some kind of freaky cult.
Yeah, well, that's what he felt like.
Yeah.
He felt like it was really strange. Now, your thing got pulled, and what was the scientific explanation for why they got pulled?
You had an
exchange with one of the guys on TED. I read the comments, and you presented all the things that he had said and said, please show your example of when I said this, I never said this.
Yeah.
What were the thing that he accused you of, and what was the response?
There were two of us who got our talks deleted.
Rupert Sheldrake.
Sheldrake is the other. His talk was called The Science Delusion. My talk was called The War on Consciousness.
He can't be shitting on science like that. Called The Science Delusion, Rupert. How dare you poke the
it was as though,
beehive.
It was as though Ted felt that these talks must automatically be wrong, and that they had some kind of preconception about what we were saying. So they didn't even bother to sit down and listen to the actual 18-minute talk. It's not that much to listen to, you know, before deleting it from their YouTube channel. They just said, this is pseudoscience. It's full of – and they listed a series of false statements that we'd supposedly made. But the problem was neither I nor Rupert had made those statements.
They never even bothered to look at it. No. They just read complaints and then responded on those complaints.
They read complaints and responded on the basis of those. So when we challenged them, okay, please go through – in my case, go through my talk and find where I say that ayahuasca allows you to communicate with an ancient mother culture. Where do I say that? I never said that in my talk. I never said any such thing in my talk. They actually couldn't do it. And
is that something you've said before?
No, I've never said that.
Never said that?
I've never
said
that.
You said it right now. I heard you.
Well,
what I talked about
was the mother goddess.
Right.
Or the experience of an encounter with a mother goddess. But I never said it allows you to communicate with an ancient mother culture, like a lost civilization. They knew I'd written books about lost civilizations. So they thought I must be bringing my lost civilization into my TED talk, which I didn't. It didn't have anything to do with lost civilization. It was a talk about consciousness. Anyway,
the original version was Giving Up the Green Bitch, where you were talking
about. I originally called the talk Giving Up the Green
Bitch.
That's
when I watched
because I was giving my personal story why I gave up cannabis. I changed that title because a lot of people pointed out to me that that's deeply disrespectful of cannabis, and that for many people cannabis is a green goddess. And cannabis was a green goddess for me, and I accepted that.
Those people, I'd say fucking relax, okay? Because I love cannabis too, but it didn't bother me.
Yeah, some people got really upset. I realized that there is in fact a cannabis orthodoxy as well, which by talking about my quitting of cannabis, I had upset this orthodoxy. But when I looked at my talk was much more about the war on consciousness than it was about that. That's what it was really about. So, for example, I made the point that our society doesn't object in principle to altering consciousness. I mean, what happens when you put a kid on Ritalin? You know, that's a powerful pharmacological drug which is altering consciousness. When you overprescribe Prozac or Ciroxat for conditions of depression, that those drugs are altering consciousness. We value alcohol. We invest, you know, have multi-billion-dollar alcohol industry. People don't primarily drink alcohol because of the taste. They drink it because it alters their consciousness in a way that they like. And so we don't object to altering consciousness in principle, but we object to altering consciousness in certain kinds of ways which threaten the status quo. And that's what psychedelics do. They alter consciousness in ways that lead people to ask profound questions about the nature of the society they live in. And that appears to be the line that I crossed. So Ted tried to dress it up as pseudoscience. And when I called them on that, in the end, because they realized, I think, that they'd got themselves into some kind of danger. And it's still there on the webpage that Rupert and I call it their naughty corner. They created a naughty corner of the TED website where our talks were put back online. And with all their reasons why they'd taken them off. So first thing they did was they crossed out all their reasons. So you can find that everything they said has actually been crossed out. And then they published our rebuttal.
Deleted. So completely deleted?
No, insisted that they accepted that nothing they'd said was true.
Uh-huh.
But we insisted they leave it there on the public record, but put a line through it.
Oh, wow.
So they did that? They did that. They did that.
Oh, my God.
They did that. And then
that's kind of a cool victory.
I know. And they published our rebuttals in full. But it wasn't a complete victory because what they didn't do, which is all we wanted, was for our talks to be reinstated on the TEDx YouTube channel.
Not only that, but you can't put your talk online yourself.
Well, no, I have put my talk online myself.
You have.
And so have about 100 other YouTube channels.
Oh, beautiful.
And I think TED took such a massive beating over this because it clearly was an act of censorship.
Mm-hmm.
However they tried to dress it up, that they've decided not to go and pull the talks from YouTube, which probably they could do. So, I mean, my talk had 132,000 views on YouTube, on their channel when they pulled it. But since then, it's had hundreds of thousands of more views all over the internet. So, you know, rather than actually suppress the talk, I think it's called the Streisand effect, you know, rather than suppress the talks, they ended up multiplying. Same with Rupert's talk.
How is that a Streisand effect?
Apparently, I think it was Barbara Streisand tried to stop some public statement that had been made about her, and it ended up multiplying the statement. You know, when you try, this is the great thing about the internet. When you try to suppress something, it grows. It doesn't get suppressed. The internet is
including dick pictures.
It is.
Got one of those out there. Coming back around, Graham Hancock. I'm going to find you.
I've never had my dick photographed.
Congratulations.
How about you?
I plead the fifth. So now the page got pulled. Your talk got pulled. It got reinstated. They crossed a line
in the naughty corner,
And put up in the naughty corner. But at least it's on YouTube as well.
Yeah,
and
all over YouTube. Yeah.
But is it possible that this is what I know? Okay, I really love your work. I've been a fan ever since Fingerprints of the Gods. It was a fascinating book that really changed the way I looked at history. I think you're a brilliant guy. But I take more shit for you from the like extreme science dorks. Mm-hmm. I take more shit about having you. Well, is Graham Hancock gonna come on your podcast and pump out his pseudoscience?
Yes.
Like so many people get so twatty about you, and it's a science thing, and it could be mistakes that you've made in the past. We all make them they want to chirp on. Yeah. It could be the whole Mars thing, the whole face on Mars thing. You got a little kooky with that. Mm-hmm. Got a little kooky with that.
I still think it's an interesting phenomenon.
It is interesting. Yeah. There's a lot of interesting rocks on Mars.
Yeah.
It might have at one point in time had a culture on
it. We don't know what they are.
No.
We need to do more work. But yeah, I have annoyed scientists. I tell you what, it's not actually I've certainly made mistakes. And,
right.
And
what about junk DNA? There was something about the contents of junk DNA. That's one thing that they keep harping on.
They keep talking about that.
That you had erroneously stated, you know, something about the knowledge that we have of junk DNA.
Well, yes, I said that 97% of DNA is defined as junk, and maybe it isn't, and that there may be data stored on DNA.
Mm-hmm.
And as a matter of fact, this is now being done. Data is being stored on DNA.
So you just were misinformed?
I don't think that I was misinformed. I think that I was exploring an interesting area of inquiry. And it's true since I published on that in 2005 that some new work has been done on so-called junk DNA, and it is found to have an important biophysical function. But what I reported, and this was in my book Supernatural in 2005, was a study published in the magazine Science by Eugene Stanley, which looked at the language-like structure of junk DNA. The junk DNA has a structure very similar to all human languages. There are certain patterns that repeat in languages that appear also in junk DNA.
Mm-hmm.
And this, I simply wanted to speculate on this. Is it possible that junk DNA is some kind of archive? I was looking, you know, when I wrote Supernatural, I was looking at this connection with entities that people have in altered states of consciousness. And I was saying that kind of place I would, you know, bet on is that in some weird way these entities may be real. That is in itself a very annoying statement to make to any materialist scientist.
Right.
But then I said, but maybe there's another possibility. Maybe there's an archive of information stored on all our DNA all around the world, and maybe in altered states of consciousness we gain access to the archive, and that's maybe why people from all different cultures at different periods of history see the same thing. And I cited the work of Francis Crick, who was the discoverer of the double helix form of DNA, in a book that he wrote called Life Itself, where Crick speculates that DNA did not evolve on this planet. This is the Nobel Prize winner, Francis Crick. This is not Graham Hancock who's making this statement. Crick suggests a phenomenon called directed panspermia, that the reason that life exploded so rapidly and amazingly on this planet within 100 million years of the planet being cool enough to support life, roughly 4 billion years ago, the reason that it exploded so suddenly was that it came here from elsewhere. And he suggested that there had been some advanced alien culture on the other side of the galaxy that faced annihilation. Perhaps a supernova was going to go off in their vicinity. And they looked desperately for some way to preserve life. And their first thought was, could they get themselves off the planet? And they realized that, yes, they could, but that they could not travel through interstellar space for thousands or millions of years to reach other possibly habitable planets. So in the end, what they did was they sent bacteria out into the universe on spaceships. And they genetically engineered those bacteria to make them incredibly hardy. This was Crick's suggestion, not mine. And the only
you got to really say that.
The only thing I added to it was if his theory had were right, and that life spiraled up on this planet because one of those spaceships hit the ancient Earth and spilled out its cargo of genetically engineered bacteria, well, maybe they wrote a message on the DNA of those bacteria. And maybe that message has been preserved, highly preserved, and there are certain strands of DNA that are preserved for hundreds of millions or billions of years and passed down into modern human beings. And maybe it's a message for us about that lost ancestor culture that made the DNA that, or rather didn't make it, but engineered the DNA in the bacteria that started life on Earth and that eventually evolved into us. And it was just an interesting inquiry.
By the way, this lends credence to the idea that Francis Crick did a lot of acid.
Well, which he certainly did. Francis Crick.
Some deny this. Michio Kaku wouldn't agree with me on this.
No, Francis Crick was a big user of acid, and so were
supposedly,
many,
allegedly.
So were many intellectuals in that period.
This is essentially the Prometheus story.
I guess
in
it
a lot
is,
of ways.
Yeah, I guess it is. So I thought it was an interesting area to inquire.
Yes.
See, for me, I feel my role is to inquire into interesting things that are forbidden territory for scientists. And when I inquire into them, it doesn't mean that I'm insisting this is a fact. What I'm saying is this is something that we need an alternative point of view on, and let's look at and consider what this might mean. And I may be completely wrong, but I think the exploration is worthwhile. That's the position that I take. But it does annoy scientists. I think the other reason it annoys scientists is because I don't mean to pat myself on the back, but I'm not particularly lunatic, you know, on a day-to-day basis. I'm not particularly kooky. I'm moderately rational. I can make an argument. I can express things. And I think if I was, you know, an obvious nutcase, they wouldn't need to get so angry with me.
Mm-hmm.
But because I'm fairly reasonable and open to discussion and persuasion, I think it makes me a little bit more dangerous to them. And it's the same with John Anthony West. John is a very reasonable man, you know. He's coming up with extraordinary ideas about the past. But he's arguing them very, very well and very coherently and based on evidence.
Intellectual ideas also are the battlefield of scientists and science thinkers and science dorks. I mean,
yeah.
Proving someone incorrect is a huge feather in your cap. Being able to point out inconsistencies, correcting mistakes.
And that's how science works.
Yes.
And that's what's good
about
science.
It, yes.
On the one hand, it's what's good about science, which is what you would call destructive criticism.
Mm-hmm.
Here is a new idea. Let's figure out any way we can to destroy it.
Mm-hmm.
If anything is left after we've exposed it to that fire for a decade, that thing that's left is probably worthwhile. That is the scientific method. I think there's room for another method. Here's this extraordinary idea that somebody put over. Let's look for what's good in that idea.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see if we can find something good
something
in that.
If there's something possible.
Idea. Yeah, see if there's something possible there.
Same approach, just in a positive way.
Just in a positive way rather than a negative way. So,
right.
You know, I think that both are possible.
It's the same attitude, essentially. You're trying
to
find truth.
Yeah.
It's just you're saying, is there a possibility of this? Is there a truth in here?
Yeah.
And is there a benefit? Like, that's what a real Egyptologist would do if they examined a Sphinx. They would say, you know, this really bears some consideration.
Yeah.
This is really unique.
Yeah.
It's unusual.
Geologists
seem to be pointing to this. Yeah. Let's discuss this further rather
than just get rid of it right at the beginning and massively
laughing?
Destroy.
What culture are we talking about from 10,000 years ago?
Exactly, exactly. And so with this destructive method, scientists seek to destroy each other's reputations.
Right.
And so, you know, many, many great individuals have suffered most painful experiences as a result of this, but have ended up later to be proved to be right.
Sometimes.
Not in plenty of
quacks out there, too, and they need to be exposed.
Sure, there are quacks.
You know, one of the things I'm doing this new show on the Sci-Fi Channel. It's called Joe Rogan Questions Everything. Mm. And eventually, I would like to get to the mysteries of ancient civilizations,
yes.
Whether or not there were some sort of Atlantean-type civilizations.
Sure.
And I would love to talk to you about this. But what I'm seeing when I'm doing this show is how important science really is. I'm getting a massive dose of the reality of how many people are really kooky out there and have some really kooky ideas that they cling to like a cat stuck in a tree.
Yeah.
And they won't let go of these fucking kooky ideas. And no matter how many experts you bring in there that are true experts on whatever subject it is at hand, if that person has a kooky idea that they've clung to, they are not letting that fucking thing go.
No, they'll never let it go.
That's why science is so important.
No, science is incredibly important.
It's the ego part that's a problem, right?
I am sitting here in this chair with a pain-free hip as a result of science.
Yeah.
That is science. Science gave me my legs back. Science gave me my mobility.
Science is how we're doing this podcast.
Science is how we're doing this podcast. It's a wonderful thing. It's an incredible instrument. We should not despise it in itself. But we should, I think, be open to the view that there are other modes of inquiry into the nature of reality which should be also considered and could even be done
scientifically.
For example, psychedelics are a marvelous tool for inquiring into consciousness, this mystery of consciousness, and we could have detailed scientific studies. So here's the hypothesis. With psychedelics, we retune the receiver wavelength of the brain and gain access to other levels of reality, parallel universes, if you like, which are inhabited by intelligent beings. Okay, let's explore that hypothesis scientifically. How are we going to do that? Psychedelics, very best way, put people into deeply altered states of consciousness on cue, you know, and then get them to compare notes, get them to ask questions of those entities, see if any new information, any novel information comes back that couldn't possibly have been known, you know, that kind of thing. It's being done, interestingly, with near-death research. That's another area where most materialist mainstream scientists will say, nonsense, there's no possibility of any kind of survival of death. But people report these astonishing near-death experiences, and they report seeing things that they should not have been able to see. So now in operating theaters, in emergency rooms, in a number of hospitals in London, but also I believe in the United States as well, they have created shelves up at a high level where they have placed certain images, and they are recording the data right now. When people have a near-death experience and they have had the sense of leaving their bodies and being up around the ceiling, have they seen these images? If they've seen those images and it can be documented scientifically, then, you know, we have to think again about consciousness.
So they're putting the images up there specifically to catch people looking?
Yeah. Yeah. So when the guy comes back, when he flatlines and he's considered to be brain dead and they bring him back to life, and this is happening more and more with advanced resuscitation techniques, many of them report having experiences out of their body. Well, now here's a scientific way to test that. Is that imagination or is there something real going on?
And what's the data so far? Have people seen those images? Have they had
hits? There's some quite compelling data, but there's an elusive nature to the phenomenon. Which is that very often when somebody has a near-death experience, they've had it in the one theater that didn't have the images on view. So they're looking for a
way. How convenient.
How convenient. They're looking for a way around this, which might involve using like iPad devices, which can be moved around very rapidly and placed in certain spots.
Where they resuscitate people.
Where they're resuscitating people.
I think this is part of the issue. You know, when we say, why doesn't science do this, or what if science did that, I really don't think it's science. I think science and the scientific method are awesome and very hugely important.
Yeah.
I think it's people.
Yeah.
I think the issue is people, it's personalities, it's people's style of communication, it's people's styles of interaction and the sense of competition that they have with exchanging ideas and with exploring ideas.
Yeah.
There's a massive amount of competition involved in being intellectually correct.
Yeah.
Getting those points,
we're all human, we all want to be right.
It's a competition forum. I mean, I've seen it on my message board, I've seen it on Reddit. When you're writing something, you're not just writing something, you're also sort of expressing yourself in a way that you would like to get brownie points for, that you would like to be powerful.
Yourself, your good name, everything into what you say. And you would like people, we all want to be liked.
So when people go to battle about ideas, the real issue is ego. It's humans. Sure. It's not the scientific method.
Yeah.
Which the scientific method should most certainly be applied to psychedelics. It should most certainly be applied to every aspect of the known world.
Yeah.
And in fact, if that was the case, then more people would probably do psychedelics, and we'd have less of an issue in the first place.
I would rather think so.
So you're not an anti-science guy. You're just an anti-asshole guy.
Thank you. That's a really good way to put it. You
know what I mean? I think, but there's a label that people like to throw on you, that you're anti-scientific.
I think that's
one of the ways that this TED thing built momentum.
Yeah.
And when,
They do like to throw that label. As a matter of fact...
Pseudoscience.
As a matter of fact, it's one of the reasons, amongst many, why I've started to write fiction as well as nonfiction. Because if I explore extraordinary ideas in the realm of fiction, I'm not actually then making a claim that this is fact.
Right.
Nevertheless, the ideas are there to be explored in what I've written. So it becomes possible to enter into an inquiry into the nature of reality without having to create this huge superstructure of defense against attacks by scientists. And I think it's a very useful way forward as far as I'm concerned, because I did find that writing nonfiction more and more, because I've become this target figure for scientists, required me to bulletproof my arguments in ways that make them, frankly, a bit boring to read, you know. And I quite like the liberation of not having to do that.
Yeah, I agree. I think your ideas are always very novel, and you're a very interesting dude. But I think in a lot of ways you're sort of a bard, you know. You're a great storyteller, and you're an exciter of the imagination and an inspirer of questions.
Thank you. I feel that's what I'm supposed to do.
That's what you do best, man. That book, Fingerprints of the Gods, got me looking at so many different aspects of our culture and then questioning how we got to this point in the first place, how it is that I get up in the morning, I get in my car, and I drive to work. As I was doing this after reading your book, I was thinking how strange it is that we live in this society where I was born in 1967. I was, you know, the cities have been here since I was a baby. Mm-hmm. Cars have been here. I've assumed that they've always been here. But then when you really stop and think about what a short period of time 2,500 BC is, or what a short period of time even 30,000 BC is.
Yeah.
That's nothing, man. In the history of the world, it's all a blink.
Yes.
It's a nothing. And we are in the middle of this. We wake up.
Yeah.
Being born is like waking up in the middle of a trip.
Yes.
Like, where are we? Where are we going? Yeah. Yeah. And that's the entire collective culture. And that was really probably the first time I ever really considered that, was in reading your book.
Yeah.
And that made me so excited about history. I wasn't excited about history from school. I mean, I took the obligatory classes.
I'm really glad to have had that effect, and it makes me feel good. As I'm getting on in life, one of the things that makes me feel good is the feedback that I do get from people who've read my books, and of which I've sweated blood in order to write, and I've taken a lot of attacks from doing that. But I find this is the new thing for me. You know, Facebook. I mean, I'm a novice at Facebook, but I've started to interact really quite strongly on my Facebook pages. I enjoy the interaction that I get there. I enjoy the new ideas that are put to me by others. And frankly, it's really nice when some kid in his 20s writes to me and says he read Fingerprints of the Gods and it changed the way that he looks at the world. That makes me feel I've done something right anyway. In all the mistakes I may have made, I've done something right.
You've done quite a bit right. But one of the things I think that you haven't done yet that you could totally be amazing at is your own podcast.
Mm-hmm.
You're a wind-up guy. I could press you. I could start you up. What's this ayahuasca stuff? Bang, press play, and
go,
you will do the dance and captivate with amazing descriptions and this very entrancing and way of communicating.
Interesting thought.
And I think that's the people like that are really important in culture, and most scientists are boring as fuck. And even though they're doing amazing work, and we wouldn't be communicating if it wasn't for some boring scientists.
Sure.
The reality is, you're not going to excite people with that shitty personality of yours.
Yeah. Yeah,
and it's not all of them. I mean, Feynman was legendarily charismatic.
There's some great charismatic scientists.
As was Carl Sagan. You know, Neil deGrasse Tyson is brilliant in that regard.
Yeah.
He's a brilliant man, and he's brilliant. He's captivating and entertaining, and he draws you in. And they're very important as well.
They're important as well. No.
There's a lot of.
Well, I will look at the
podcast, my friend.
Now that I've kind of initiated myself into the internet world and got talking to people on Facebook and so on, and my website, you know, all of these things are way. And the one thing I haven't done, I do have a YouTube channel, but what I don't have is a podcast, and it might be something I'm
massively important. Yeah. It's the best way to communicate with people because even in writing, sometimes things are lost in tone, the way you could be sarcastic and just joking around. You actually have to write it, just kidding, you know. Yeah. You have to actually quantify it, whereas people know in the inflection of your voice, the look on your face. Mm. That's why we like to do this. Even though most of the people listen to this podcast, mm-hmm. we like to have an iTunes version so you can see sometimes we're making silly faces. We're joking around.
Yeah.
I think for you, it would be an excellent way to explore new ideas, things that come to you, and also respond to people online.
Yeah.
Instead of like sitting there and writing everything out, pick a few emails every week and respond to them.
Very good thought.
It's great.
I will take your advice.
It's perfect for you.
I will take your advice on this.
What was the argument against Rupert Sheldrake, from what I read online, was a bit stronger than the argument for you?
No, I don't think so. No? Again, they attributed statements to him that he didn't make.
So it was more the same type of thing?
It was the same type of thing.
What was his controversy?
Well, he's saying that science is locked in what we call a materialist reference frame, which is that it seeks to reduce everything to matter.
Mm-hmm.
And that there cannot be, and so therefore, the idea of telepathy, for example, is an impossible idea as far as mainstream science is concerned. Because if your consciousness is simply something that's generated by your brain, why? How can you then pick up the thoughts of somebody else, you know, across a continent or on the other side of the world? How is that possible? So he is questioning the materialist reference frame of mainstream science. And since the most vocal advocates of mainstream science are materialists, who believe that consciousness is an accidental epiphenomenon of brain activity, that there is nothing else to it than that, he got under a lot of skins.
Well, there's also the ones that don't believe that and haven't clearly defined what consciousness is, but say if psychic abilities do exist, show them. Exhibit them.
Yeah. Well, that's precisely what Rupert has done. Yes.
But what has he done clearly that shows, in your opinion?
Well, for example, documenting the sense of being stared at, that people know when they're being stared
right.
at. And he's done experiments which document this and prove it at a level of statistical significance.
A couple percent, right?
Yeah, a couple of percent. Why does your dog know when you're coming home?
Has that been disproven ever?
No.
No.
Even though the owner of the dog varies the route, comes home by a different route in a different way every
this
day.
This might be your wife calling.
Yeah, that's probably Santa.
Hello?
Oh, it's your neighbor.
Oh, yeah, she's here. Okay. We'll have someone come out and get her right now. Thank you very much. All right, Jamie, just go out and tell her we'll wrap this up.
Yeah.
That's our neighbor.
Yeah,
she must have been knocking on the door.
Well, this is the great thing about a live discussion.
It's beautiful.
When my wonderful Sartha turns up at the door and can't get in, she's got a telephone.
Well, it's cool because people know that it's not some etiquette. Yeah. You know, it's not edited and polished.
Yeah.
It's a real conversation in that way.
It's a real,
you know, like we couldn't have this conversation afterwards and you say, you know, that thing about science. Maybe I said something. Could we cut that out?
Exactly.
No.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's raw. It's real, and it works. Can I say a couple of things which I would like people to hear?
Sure.
One is this is an odd thing to ask because I've been very successful as a non-fiction author, but I am hoping that people will pay attention to my fiction,
right?
And that people will listen to my fiction. It's very, very difficult for me to be published as a novelist. The publishing industry want me to stay in my box as a successful nonfiction author, and they don't want me to explore the fictional side of things. So I've managed to get a British publisher for my novel, which we talked about earlier, War God, about the Spanish conquest of Mexico. But so far, I don't have an American publisher. And I have been helped a lot by my Facebook community, many of whom are Americans, who have gone to Amazon UK and bought the British edition of my book from America. And it will be delivered to them here in America in a few days, because the book is published on the 30th of May. And if anybody's interested in that story, I would appreciate if they'd make the effort to go to Amazon UK and pick up the book, because what that does then is it gives the book the possibility of some success in Britain. And if it succeeds in Britain, then it will be picked up by an American publisher.
So it's only the resistance is just that it's nonfiction?
Yeah, that's right. Publishing industry is an industry that thinks in terms of brands. And I am branded as a nonfiction author.
This is your second nonfiction book.
It's my second.
Did your first one sell well?
My first novel vanished without a trace because that was called Entangled.
Uh-huh.
Because it had absolutely no support from the publishers at all. It sold a few thousand copies, but really it was completely ignored. And the same thing is going to happen with War God as well. What I've done is I've put free to read chapters online on my website.
And that is grahamhancock.com?
And that's www.grahamhancock.com.
We got to fix your Twitter, man. This double underscore is confusing a
lot
of
people.
Well,
I know it is, but I couldn't get that name. I couldn't get at Graham Hancock. I got at Graham.
Who is Graham Hancock? Who's the at Graham Hancock?
Well, there's another guy with my name.
And his name is Graham Hancock?
Yeah, his name is Graham Hancock. He got it first, so nothing can be done.
Just that double underscore. Yeah. Couldn't you just do something else? Like Graham Hancock in one word?
No, that's what he's got.
He's got it. Oh, well, how about, do you have a middle name?
Graham Bruce Hancock.
Graham B. Hancock?
Yeah.
How about that? Yeah. No, that's stupid.
Yeah.
Forget it. Forget what I said.
I know, Graham. Yeah, you know, my mother, bless her, when she gave me my name, she had in my, so my initials are G.B. Hancock, okay?
Right.
When she gave me my name,
how about
she,
that?
She was thinking of, yeah, that's what I use on my email address. She was thinking
hey,
of...
Hey, you fucked up. Someone's going to hit you with an email
they
now.
They hit me with emails anyway. It's okay. She was thinking, in a rather grandiose way, of George Bernard Shaw, you know, G.B. Hancock. So she called me G.B. Hancock, not realizing that G.B.H. also stands for grievous bodily harm, you know.
Oh, it does?
In Britain, in British law, yeah, that's a particular crime, you know, that you've committed an act of GBH against somebody. So that's my initials. I don't know what to do about my Twitter name.
Maybe we'll just have to keep it double underscore. So there's an underscore, Graham
since,
underscore.
Since this
Hancock
is live,
as well?
Can I introduce my Santa?
Sure, if she wants to.
Santa, come here.
Hi, Santa.
Hi.
What's
come,
up?
Come.
He's all so happy now that he quit weed. Yeah. Look at him.
Completely. Yes.
Are you happier now that you quit weed?
Absolutely.
Wow.
Thank God.
I'm down. That's hilarious.
Yeah. No, simply because he was abusing the substance.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, I understand.
And yeah, it was the substance controlling him, or being in control of him, as opposed to him being in control of the substance.
So. Yeah, we went deep into it.
Yeah.
It's interesting stuff. Do you have this on Kindle?
Yes, but you have to buy it in England, and I think there's some things that make it difficult for Americans to buy the Kindle edition. They can only buy the hardback edition.
Oh, that's so stupid.
But there's links on my website which go to the right place to buy it, and there's chapters to read so people can make. I'm not asking people to buy it blind. People can make up their own minds, read the chapters. If they hate it, don't buy it.
Well,
you know?
Graham Hancock, one of our sponsors, is Audible.com.
Is audible.com.
Yeah, do you have an audio
version?
Okay,
now the US edition of my first novel, Entangled, is available on Audible. But now I do not have.
Did you read it?
Huh? No, I didn't. It was read by somebody else. Yeah.
Do you like the person who read it? Was it good?
Nice.
That's got to be weird.
Nice
reading
voice.
Or hearing someone read your words.
It's weird if they don't do it well, but in this case it was done well.
Wow. Yeah, you don't want to buy Stephen King's when he reads them. That's the only,
advice. I've not had that pleasure.
I'm a huge Stephen King fan.
Me
but boy,
too.
Does
Stephen King is brilliant.
He's amazing. His book on writing is equally amazing.
Fantastic
Stephen
book.
King on writing?
On writing. On so, writing.
Yeah, if you are a writer, there's two books you need. The War of Art and Stephen King on writing. Those are the two.
The other one is Stephen Pressfield's The War on Art.
One, Turning Pro, which is equally brilliant.
Yeah, fantastic.
But don't ever get an audio book that Stephen King reads because he's fucking boring as shit.
Okay.
He'll put you right to sleep. I mean, the guy's the greatest author ever, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, but I agree. He is the best. He writes just an amazing narrator, the amazing stories. He's got the gift, fantastic gift of writing a story.
Yeah, I remember reading some of his stuff when I was a young teenager, like thinking, like, Jesus, I shouldn't even be reading this.
Yeah.
Like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
Like, his descriptions, like, they bordered on creepy, like some of the sexual stuff. And
yeah.
He's just a beast.
Yeah, yeah. But he's also... been given a gift by the universe
to
write amazing stories that make you want to keep turning the pages. And you're right, his book on writing, for anybody who aspires to become a writer, that is the first place you go, is read Stephen King on writing.
Yeah, it's a brilliant book, and he's so forthcoming about all of his trials and struggles, and he's amazing. And that's my favorite kind of movie is his books, like where it's just fantasy. Mm-hmm. I don't need things to be real in my fiction.
No.
You know, I enjoy fiction, but I don't need to see like a really depressing movie where everybody's got cancer and oh my god, so brilliantly acted. Stop. No, entertain me. Show me an evil car that kills people.
Yeah.
You know?
Exactly.
Show me the dude next door neighbor's a werewolf. Exactly. You know?
I think that's the writer's first task. The fiction writer's first task is to entertain.
You said witches in this. Did you throw some supernatural shit in this as well?
The War God is full of the supernatural. And I was able to bounce off the facts because the Aztec society has been rightly described as the last magical civilization. They were involved in magic and witchcraft in a huge way, but they also persecuted witches, just as European society in the Middle Ages persecuted witches. So there's strong supernatural elements in this story, and in a way I think it's only possible to understand what happened between 1519 and 1521 when you take the beliefs in the supernatural into account.
Yeah, it sounds like they were, I mean, what your description of a nation of serial killers is apt.
That's what the Aztecs were. That's what the Aztecs were. And here's the thing, you see. I mean, my two central female characters meet in what's called a fattening pen. So this is what the Aztecs did. They're human sacrificial victims. They would, first of all, they would fatten them up in prisons.
Why would they fatten them?
Because they wanted to present them to the god plump and desirable. So they would fatten them for months on end. And can you imagine living, that's your situation, you've been put in the fattening pen, they're feeding you this high-calorie diet, and at a certain date you're going to be marched up the pyramid and have your heart cut out. That takes some courage to resist.
That Teotihuacan sacrifice of 4 days of 80,000 people. I told that to my friend Steve Rinella, and he didn't even believe me.
Yeah, Tenochtitlan, by the way.
Tenochtitlan. How do you say it?
Tenochtitlan. That was the ancient name of Mexico City. It used to be an island in the middle of a lake approached by causeways.
And the temple was called Teotihuacan?
No, that's actually 35 miles north of Mexico City. That's a place, that's the Pyramid of the Sun, the Pyramid of the Moon, and the Pyramid of Quetzalcoatl, which the Aztecs revered as the place where men became gods. That is what, but they didn't know who made Teotihuacan. Teotihuacan was already remotely ancient when the Aztecs came into the Valley of Mexico and encountered it.
So the Pyramid of the Sun, the completion of that was when they killed 80,000 people.
No. That was the Pyramid of the War God.
Oh, the Pyramid of the War.
Which is why my novel is called War God.
Oh.
And that stood in the heart of what is now Mexico City. And when the Spanish took that city, the very first thing they did was to take that pyramid apart stone by stone.
Did you see what happened in Belize recently?
Yeah, so an ancient Mayan pyramid is used as a construction material by some asshole firm who used diggers to just break down the body of the pyramid and use it to make roads.
Yeah. How crazy is
kind
that?
Kind of sums up everything that's wrong with our culture.
That's not our culture.
Well,
that's the place where John McAfee was living.
You know that whole
craziness?
Absolutely. I refer to global culture. Global culture,
humanity.
Of production and consumption.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It was astounding that someone would be willing to do that. You're destroying an archaeological site for its limestone.
Yeah.
Like that is some short-sighted assholes.
Yeah,
it's incredible.
But doesn't that short-sightedness, that the pursuit of short-term goals, which might be immediately profitable, even though long-term massively damaging, doesn't that actually completely sum up everything that's wrong with global culture today? I mean, if you wanted to take one act which kind of expresses it, that would be it. But, you know, we don't think long-term. We don't think in terms of the sacred. We don't – the Amazon jungle. Nobody considers, you know, when it's being exploited as an economic resource, what that means for our planet in the long run if all of those trees come down. Short-term, some money might be made out of it. Long-term – we're losing the lungs of our planet.
Well, the pattern is the real issue with human beings is our ability to do things in large numbers that would be horrific if we did singularly.
Yes.
You know, the diffusion of responsibility that comes from acting as a corporation or acting as an army or acting where horrific things can be justified because you're only a part of one huge group of people that are doing these things.
There's been some, we talked about science, there's been some interesting science done on exactly that point. which is that they set it up with actors. You put a situation where somebody is on the street and they're in jeopardy. A woman is perhaps being attacked. If there are two or three people walking on the street, they will almost always intervene to prevent the attack.
Yeah.
But if there's 1,000 people walking on the street, nobody intervenes.
Yeah, well, I think that happens most of the time. It can happen, but I think a lot of people would intervene.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's one of those weird things that is like a psychological principle that gets brought up as a sort of as a matter of fact. Mm. I don't necessarily think it's a matter of fact, because if I saw someone raping someone, I'd kick their ass.
But you might be.
I would try at least.
You might be the extraordinary exception.
I don't think so.
No?
I think there's a lot of people who jump in. But you hear stories like that all the time, where people save someone from this and did something there. I think it's more likely that cowards would walk away if there's 1,000 people, but there's still out of 1,000 people.
Still somebody with guts who's going to do something about
somebody
it.
Somebody who realizes we're all in this together and you wouldn't want it to be.
I hope you're right. I share your faith in the human race. I think we have amazing potential, amazing capacity to love, amazing capacity to give, amazing generosity and decency. That's what I encounter day to day.
Yeah, for the most part, right?
Yeah.
Mostly people are awesome.
Yeah.
It's just a few of these Montezuma motherfuckers running around killing everybody.
Yeah.
And throughout history, there's been, you know, giant groups of people led by serial killers.
Yeah, unfortunately.
And that's a big part of reality.
They're the ones who go for that job.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of this podcast called Hardcore History that I talk about all the time. But I've been listening to it. Lately, it's been talk about the Nazis and World War II, but it's when you go back and pay attention to some of the things that happened in history, and you see the amazing level of ruthlessness that people exhibited against their enemies just throughout the history of humans. There's been groups that flared up, whether it's the Mongols or the Nazis or the Romans, or there's been so many groups of ruthless people.
Still happening now, Joe.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, when a drone flies over a village in Afghanistan or Pakistan and 120 people get slaughtered.
Yeah.
It's a bit remote. It's a bit distant. We're not getting our hands dirty, but people are still being killed.
Well, it's crazy.
Children are being deprived of their parents.
The children are dying. Children are getting maimed. And the numbers are so skewed in the favor of people who were casualties that were innocent.
Mm.
There's way more people that are innocent that are getting killed by these drones.
Of course, yeah.
And then they say, well, that's because these terrorists, they do things in highly populated areas. Well, then you can't do that. You can't just say we're going to kill. That is one of the most un-American things you could ever do.
It's a terrible un-American thing.
The idea that you could kill all these oppressed, innocent people just to get this one bad guy.
Yeah. It's patently, obviously wrong. And yet at the level of government, nobody seems to have got it yet, how wrong it is.
It's diffusion of responsibility in a digital, technological form, a warfare form.
Yeah,
completely. I mean, no one's even there. I mean, this is what we can do. Instead of doing some horrific war crimes, we send soldiers in there to slaughter all these innocents to get these bad people.
Yeah.
Instead of doing that, which is totally unacceptable, we'll just do it this way, where you're not even really there.
Yeah, like some guy is sitting in a control tower playing a computer game, really.
Well, how about the fact they're going to give them medals? That was one of the big things. They're going to give drone pilots medals, and people are like, what are you doing?
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is getting bananas.
No act of courage is involved.
Well, apparently there's been a new scandal where 4 Americans were killed in a recent drone strike, and now Obama is trying to restrict the use of drones and trying to say that they can't be used on Americans.
Mm-hmm.
But whatever. We live in strange times.
We live in strange times.
Is it because our humanity has not yet caught up to our technological capabilities that we are evolved technologically so much in the past several hundred years? We've like literally changed the world entirely, but yet the tissue, the DNA, the echoes of the past that lie in our language and in our cultures is really not caught up by any stretch of the imagination.
I think that's a good point. I think that's a good point. We've got these incredible toys, but we haven't learned to play with them responsibly yet.
Yeah, we've got this barbaric mindset that's still in place to run shit. If you want to run shit, you got to be a fucking savage.
The mindset hasn't changed that much in the last 1,000 or 500 years.
But yet we're hopeful.
But we're hopeful, and I remain hopeful. I think it's a wonderful thing to be human. It's a great gift to be born in a human body. We have this, you know, that's part of it, actually, is the what it, the human predicament is the predicament of making choices between alternatives, between good and evil, between dark and light. And the our world we live in today is filled with darkness and with light. But the one thing that all of us can do as individuals is we can make the right choice rather than the wrong choice. We don't have to add to the misery in the world, not even one tiny fraction. We always got the choices we make, those are our responsibility alone. And no, we cannot devolve those on others. We can't say it's the government's fault. The choices we make are our choices.
And that is the message of ayahuasca, isn't
it? Yes, that's the message of ayahuasca.
That's why everybody needs it.
Yeah. Yeah, because your choices are yours, and your choices will define you.
Isn't it funny that that would be one of the single most powerful changing elements in this culture if all of a sudden ayahuasca centers started opening up and we started exploring it scientifically, we started to figure out what the contents are.
As long as those centers were run by good-hearted people.
By good-hearted people.
Who had the capacity to love and wanted the betterment of mankind, rather than who were seeking personal gain or personal power.
Evil ones in the Peru and where have you, are they taking it as well?
Yeah.
So they're taking it and doing evil things once they take it.
I'm afraid so, yeah.
Wow. So do you think that they're just psychopaths that got a hold of some ayahuasca and that you can't fix that kind of crazy?
Finally, yes. If you come to this medicine with wicked intent, then bad things can happen.
So you really believe in the idea of entities being evil? You believe in the communication of evil entities?
I think it's a very interesting possibility, which explains a lot in human history.
Demons?
Yeah, demons. I think that's a simple shorthand for it, just as there are also angels. I think that the reality is much more complicated than we imagine. That there are huge unseen realms which impact upon us in important ways, and we are interacting with them whether we like it or not. And in certain states of consciousness, that interaction can become conscious, and we can gain access to those realms. And furthermore, I would say, I believe ultimately in the unity of all things. But right now, in this particular learning experience that we're undergoing in a human incarnation, I think it's really useful that those choices exist. What, after all, if everything was all good and rosy and perfect and that were not possible to do wrong, what could we learn from this experience of life? If we don't have the opportunity to make mistakes, if we are not faced with fundamental choices, what would we benefit from in living this life in a human body?
Well, you know, that's one of the main arguments for computer simulation theory.
Excellent argument, yeah.
It's one of the main arguments is that we've got ourselves to a point where life is fucking boring because we've solved all the problems, we've eliminated all the stress and conflict,
reading
each other's minds.
That's true, we haven't solved all the problems.
But that this is a computer simulation. That the life we are living, that we're in the roaring 20s of the digital era. We're in the simulation where it's indiscernible.
Yeah, well, that, it's quite possible to imagine virtual reality, even in our technology today, getting to the point where you wouldn't know that it was virtual, where you're totally immersed in that reality. And for all we know, Joe, that's exactly what you and I are.
Well, that's the argument.
And at the end of our lifespan, our 70 or 80 years or however many years we get, you know, a random element in that, we're going to step out and find ourselves in a room and where we've been playing this game all along, and then we'll be scored on what we did, you know, and did we actually fulfill the objectives that we set out at the beginning of the game with? There you get actually with that idea of a computer simulation, you actually get to you find yourself coming full circle and meeting very ancient spiritual ideas, like that thing that I called the weighing of the soul in the ancient Egyptian system. That's where you get scored on how you performed in the computer game, and how you performed was not, you know, how much money you made or how much power you had. Maybe it was really how much love you gave. That was the thing you most needed to do.
Is it possible that the sort of fractal nature of reality manifests itself in the idea of these demons, being that in that you must reinforce good and you must punish bad, And the only way these dumb people ever really completely understand it is if they feel a physical manifestation of the evil that they've caused. And that's what a demon is. So it's just sort of a guide rail that you bump into, something that's supposed to steer you towards the positive. The very reason why you evolve after like a psychedelic trip, seeing the bad that you're doing, seeing the evil as manifested as an actual being.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where it's most terrifying, your common enemies that you have in real life, whether it's predators or enemies, they're a physical manifestation.
Absolutely.
So
we don't, you know, we don't know the answer to these questions. These we're touching here upon a great mystery. People all over the world have these experiences and report remarkably similar encounters with entities, either demonic or angelic. And this has been going on throughout human culture.
Right.
And it's a feature of the psychedelic experience as well. And we don't know what those things are. This is just not clear. Do they have an independent existence from us, or are they part of a teaching program that we need to encounter, as you're suggesting just now? I think they're very interesting questions to examine, but I don't know the answer to them.
I've always had an issue with the possibility of archetypes, too, that people have already established, that archetypes that people already have in their head, so that they, you know, when you have an abduction experience, what you think is an abduction experience, you sort of fill in the blanks with whatever these entities are. Well, all of a sudden they become these gray guys with big black eyes, because that's the cultural archetype that we've sort of subscribed to. Mm-hmm. And in all these stories, these...
Why do we find them painted on cave walls 25,000 years ago then?
It's a good question. It's a good question. Which ones do we find?
Well, particularly on the walls of, in fact, on a little alcove and a ceiling inside Pêche-Mêle cave in France, there's a fantastically recognizable depiction of what we would call a gray today.
Can you pull that up? Yeah. How do you spell it?
We call him the wounded man sometimes. He's Pêche-Mêle, P-E-C-H-M-E-R-L-E, Pêche-Mêle. And he is pierced through the body with a number of spears, and he has this kind of high-domed forehead and narrow pointed chin and just a hint of large dark eyes.
Do you think that these things are actually physically visiting, or do you think that there's a chemical doorway that's opened through psychedelics or through some technology, and that that's how they're appearing?
I think it's a chemical doorway. I think that we have a hidden doorway inside our minds through which we can project our consciousness into other levels of reality. I can't prove that, but that's what I think may be going on.
And that's what it feels to you when you experience these psychedelics.
That's what it feels to me like, that I'm entering a seamlessly convincing parallel world.
And again, I want to stress the point that because you've had this experience, these true experiences, if they're just a hallucination, a byproduct of the mind, that is impossible to prove, you're still having the exact same experience.
Yeah, you're still having the exact same experience. And there you come back to the point we made earlier, that what you then learn from that experience. And if you grow in some way through that experience, it doesn't really matter whether it's freestanding reality or whether it's something you projected.
And as we become more interconnected with our ability to communicate and our idea that the human race really is one gigantic super organism, as we accept that idea more and more, it opens up a lot of other possibilities. It opens up a lot of possibilities for just our overall view of things.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. This is the new Copernican revolution that we're poised on the edge of. You know, at one time, it was considered that the sun went around the Earth, and that all the stars revolved around the Earth, and the Earth was fixed and still in the center. And then some people started having experiences, or if you like, finding data which contradicted that, and eventually a whole worldview was thrown away. And I think we're, you know, at the edge of moving into a whole new revolution about the nature of reality, that it is just much more complicated than we've imagined. And that's a kind of sketch of the Pêche-Mêle figure. That's not the original cave painting, and I'm afraid the only UFOs that are actually present are the ones above the individual's head. The other two are not there in the painting.
So let's go see if you can find the original one, Jamie, because that one looks like shit. That looks like an animal, too. You know, who knows, but they were really terrible at drawing, too.
Oh, no, they were amazing at drawing.
Some of them were.
Some of the cave paintings are absolutely stunning.
I wouldn't pay for them. I mean, I would if I knew they were really old.
You haven't seen...
But if, like, some new dude just came along and that was his version of a buffalo, I'd be like, bitch.
You haven't seen what is painted inside Chauvet Cave in France.
Well, I watched that documentary, the Werner Herzog documentary.
So
yeah, no, it's amazing. I'm joking around,
I know,
obviously.
As you do. As
but
you do.
Still, there's, you know, I'd rather buy an Alex Gray painting. I think his shit is cooler.
Yeah, Alex
Gray. I'd like
great.
Some Frank Frazetta. You know, that's art to me.
Okay.
There's no Frank Frazetta on cave walls, right?
Okay.
They didn't really... You're like, okay.
Yeah, you know,
okay.
You know, I mean, the caves, this is one of the great experiences we can have as human beings, is to go into those painted caves and go in silence and in darkness and just get a sense of the atmosphere. They're transformative spaces. They knew something about set and setting in those times. And of course, I'm convinced they were using psychedelics.
And that was the caves in France were...
Caves in France, caves in Spain, yeah.
What are the oldest ones? The cave
the
of...
very oldest is Fumani Cave in Italy, which is 35,000 years old. Chauvet Cave, about 32,000 years old.
Wow.
They're pretty fucking ancient.
So do you think that those were people that were living in those caves? That
no,
were making that
lived,
artwork?
People never lived in those caves.
Never lived in them?
No, they didn't. They used them as sacred spaces. They visited them in small numbers, often separated. There might be an interval of 2,000 years between when one group went in and when another group went in.
So our idea of cave art, as the layperson's idea, is these cavemen were inside this cave, and then at nighttime they would light fires and draw cave art. That's not what was going on.
That's not what happened. They never lived in those spaces. They lived outside. They lived in, you know, in portable structures like teepees. They were hunter-gatherers, and they used the caves as sacred spaces, and they communicated their most profound ideas about the spirit.
So they were a lot more sophisticated than we like to believe.
They were just as sophisticated as we are.
Was there ever a time before that we know of where they weren't? Where, like, Neanderthals supposedly are being, they did some cave art as well, correct?
Yeah, this is the new discovery, that some of the very oldest cave art was almost certainly done by Neanderthals. So the Neanderthal image is due for a complete rehabilitation very, very, very soon. The Neanderthals, the image that we have of Neanderthals is completely wrong. But there's a thing I call 6 million years of boredom, which is, you know, from the last common ancestor with the chimpanzee through until well after the emergence of anatomically modern humans, our ancestors were very dull, judging by what they left behind, judging by what they produced. They were not thinking laterally. They were not creating. They were not. They did not have spiritual concepts or ideas. And it's rather like a light is switched on in the human brain all around the world, somewhere after 100,000 years ago, really 40,000 years ago, that we get this amazing explosion of symbolic art, and suddenly you recognize that the creatures are just like us, and that we are dealing with people we could communicate with on a symbolic level. So something happened to our ancestors, and I made this case extensively in my book Supernatural, that what happened to our ancestors was encounters with psychedelics. That's what took us out of the dull and boring zone and put us into the realm of imagination and creativity and spirit.
Well, it's a fascinating idea, and it's a weird one to dismiss, because we know that the impact of psychedelics on the mind is so astonishing. It's very poo-pooed and marginalized because it's thought to be frivolous and silly, but that's only by people who haven't done it.
Yeah.
It's one of the weirdest things where it's persecuted by people who really need it more than anybody.
Yeah. Well, exactly. I mean, for those who've never had a psychedelic experience, to put down others who have had it and to tell them that experience is wrong. I mean, that's like a celibate, you know, telling somebody not to have sex. The celibate has no experience of the thing that they're talking about.
Yeah.
How dare they make judgments about that?
Yeah, it's a good point. It's strange. But I think that people like you that are brave enough to speak out about this and, in fact, even write books about it,
mm-hmm.
that's the ripples that sends out this information, and the universe picks it up.
Yeah.
And the internet grabs it and duplicates it and throws it up on Twitter, and then, boom, we're off to the races. And new ideas are introduced into the minds of the young people, who I think that's what gives me hope.
That's what gives me hope, too.
Young people.
There's a fantastic growing community of alert, intelligent, awake, aware young people out there.
That grew up with the internet.
That grew up with the internet and that are not going to put up with all that shit any longer that comes down from a hierarchical, controlling, dominator culture.
Boom. Graham Hancock just dropped some science. That was a beautiful conversation, man. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Joe.
We got to do this more often.
I agree.
When are you back in America again?
Oh, late October.
So if people want to buy War God, they can go to amazon.co.uk.
Well, the easiest way to do it is to go to my website.
Okay, grahamhancock.com.
grahamhancock.com.
Okay, you already have. You have the Canadian and the UK link.
Because
up.
That's the two places so it's on sale, Amazon Canada or Amazon UK. And they can buy it there.
And hopefully, if all our friends at Audible are listening, hook it up, bitch. Get somebody to read it. Come on. I'd love to have that in my car when I'm driving around. But I'll pick it up as well. Support. Fresh.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. And is that the original K-Bart?
Yes, it is. There it is. Wow. So you can see that high domed forehead up there.
Just be shitty art. Forehead. That art
there
sucks.
You can see the dark eyes. Well, what
you
the
could,
fuck is
but you
it,
know what?
And
it's
what's
also
that, what's that up in the sky up above it? I mean, what is?
Let me
that
tell you something. I got a 3-year-old, and she draws people. They look exactly like that. She's not trying to depict aliens. She's just shitty at drawing. Well, this is, you know, it's the problem with this is it's too ambiguous. It's like that's not good art. I mean, so I don't know what that is. Is that a spider? Could be a spider. Could be a crab.
No. It's a man it's a human body.
The thing in the upper left,
With spears pierced through his body.
Okay, what about that thing in the upper left? What the hell is that?
That thing there. Nobody knows what it is.
It's a fucking shitty spider.
Nobody knows what it is.
That guy sucked. I hope that guy was way better at killing buffalo because his drawings are dog shit.
I think we need to send you into the painted cave.
I'm joking around completely. I mean, this I'm not that impressed with. I would like to look at it. I think it's fascinating because it's so old.
But actually, as a work of art, it's not impressive. But as a subject matter, what is being depicted there is rather interesting.
I sort of disagree, and this is why I disagree, because the thing in the upper left that might be a spider shows me a really rudimentary level of replicating what they're trying to draw. That looks like shit, and so this looks like shit too. I don't know what it is. It might be a bug. It might be an animal. It's like the guy sucks at drawing. He's not that good. So to try to attribute anything to it, I think it'll be a little disingenuous. So those archaeologists that, you know, are trying to figure what this thing out is, you're just guessing, man.
Same sort of image is found all over the world.
It is. The image of the gray head, right?
And also the image of the therianthrope, which is the creature that's part human and part animal in form. That is found all around the world. Often I've seen virtually identical images in the painted caves in France and in canyons in Utah, for example.
And you feel that is directly related to psychedelic
Absolutely.
Use, the spirit world.
And I think this is related to psychedelics as well. I think that's a painting of a vision, and the vision might have been not very clear, but. That's what's being painted.
I think somebody gave a 3-year-old a colored rock, and that's what they drew. That's what it looks like what my 3-year-old draws. I'm telling you, man. The idea of the morphing of
if you look at it, Google, call up Chauvet Cave, images from Chauvet Cave. I want Joe to see some beautiful images.
Oh no, I will. I will be very impressed. I'm just joking around. I'm being completely joking. And silly.
But you're right. That image is rudimentary.
What are the best images, depictions of aliens to you that you feel?
Well, first of all, let me make it clear. I don't think that we're dealing with aliens,
right.
Quote unquote.
Well, I mean that gray archetype.
I think we're dealing with a mystery. I think we're dealing with a phenomenon. And I think we as a culture or certain members of our culture are jumping to the conclusion that creatures a bit like us, perhaps looking slightly different, in very high-tech craft, are crossing interstellar space. There's a beautiful picture from Chauvet.
It's not bad.
Are crossing interstellar space and are coming here in technology. But I personally think, again, I can't prove it, but I think it's more likely we're dealing with interdimensional contacts, that these entities are not high-tech aliens from a planet a bit like ours, but they're coming to us from literally the other side of reality.
Well, my unfortunate labeling aside, calling them aliens, I meant that archetype, big that you say repeats itself over and over again.
Yeah. South Africa, for example, in the Drakensberg Mountains, images just like that.
Is that what's the best example we could pull up right now? So we just
I don't think you'd be able to pull this up.
No, they don't have those images online.
No,
this is the internet.
You might find it. I'm not.
Everything
I'm not
is on
sure.
the internet.
I'm not sure.
How could they not have that online?
I have it in my book, Supernatural.
But what is the best one that's online, in your opinion?
I honestly couldn't tell you.
Okay. I just wanted to get some. I've seen some really fascinating ones. One crazy shaman, where it's he's very strange looking creature. He looks like it could be
maybe from Shaman Cave in Texas, possibly.
Is that what it is?
Maybe.
And those are those Native American depictions. Yeah,
But then you find similar things from Tassili in Algeria. You know, these kind of glowing figures that seem to. It's very easy to construe them as alien visitors from other planets.
Why do so many drugs, like whether it's ayahuasca or there's other ones that have archetypes that are built in, like snakes and, you know, jaguars? What do you think that is? Do you think that's the experiences of the people that have taken it before you?
Well, first of all, I don't think we don't know what an archetype is.
Right.
You know, there's this idea that the human brain has all these patterns and shapes just built into it archetypally, but I think just as possible is that there are other levels of reality in which entities are able to look like that, shape-shifting entities that can take on many different forms. The experience is very universal. For example, everyone who drinks ayahuasca, pretty much everyone, if they persist with it, will encounter serpents. And those serpents aren't like your everyday serpent. You know, they're 500 feet long with, you know, mouths the size of cars and richly colored and patterned and intelligent. You know, now why is it that somebody who drinks ayahuasca in Tokyo and somebody who drinks it in New York and somebody who drinks it in the Amazon, that they all encounter these intelligent serpent entities?
Why do you think it is?
Well, I think that there's something out there which chooses to manifest in that form, and I think that it's being witnessed just as if three different explorers went into the jungle and met the same previously uncontacted tribe and came back and drew us images. And I think that there is some reality to it, but I can't prove that.
Right.
I just think that that's what's going on, and I've had enough encounters. So like Rick Strassman's work with DMT, which I know that you're familiar with because you presented the DMT, the Spirit Molecule documentary.
Yeah.
You know, that a number of his volunteers encounter entities who say to them, "We're so glad you've discovered this technology. Now we can communicate with you more often."
Right.
Yeah.
I always wonder about those trips, whether or not that's just your imagination on hyperdrive creating these
and right and proper creatures. Right and proper that you should wonder about it. But
there's also the possibility that no, it's you're communicating with something.
Yeah.
But either way, again, like we said, it's the same experience.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You're a bad motherfucker, Graham Hancock.
Thank you.
You really are. I'm glad we're
friends. I take that as a compliment.
You should, sir. You should. I'm glad we're friends. I really, really enjoy our talks. It's one of my favorite podcasts ever. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Joe. It's a real pleasure to sit down with you.
So War God, people can get it. Go to GrahamHancock.com. And on Twitter, he's Graham_Hancock. Thank you. And thank you to everybody that tuned into the podcast. Thanks to our sponsors. Thanks to Hover. Please go to Hover.com/Rogan. Get yourself 10% off. Thank you to Stamps.com. Click on the microphone in the upper right-hand corner and use the code word JRE. And thank you also to Onnit.com. Go to Onnit. Use the code name Rogan and save yourself 10% off any and all supplements. We will be back on Monday with Dave Asprey. A lot of people really enjoyed his first talk, and he's got a lot of new information. I know a lot of folks have questions about the whole Bulletproof Exec. Go to bulletproofexec.com if you want to prepare for this and find out what the fuck Dave Asprey is all about. But he's a brilliant guy, and we look forward to talking to him on Monday. All right. Thank you, everybody. Much love. Big kiss.